Members, I'd like to call the meeting to order. The Health and Human Service Finance Committee is called to order on Tuesday, April 3rd. We're in a continuation. I'm sorry. Well, it says Thursday, April 3rd on my sheet, but apparently it's Thursday, April 4th. So let's get the days right. Sorry about that. We don't have any minutes from yesterday yet. They're not quite ready, so we're just going to let those move ahead with us when we meet again. Right now, we're going to continue on with House File 1233, Representative Huntley's bill. I do want to let members know that we have two other bills that are going to come up, hopefully, this morning. So we'd like to kind of move this along at a reasonable pace here, though I want to make sure everyone's questions are answered. We do have two additional sheets you've all been given, just like yesterday, that you can kind of follow along. We will lightly touch the topics that have been discussed before and go into a little more depth on the new items to the governor's budget. So, Representative Huntley, would you like to start us off? I think Ann Berry maybe is going to testify with you.
Madam Chair and members, in this morning's meeting on House File 1233, we're going to go through the chemical, mental health, and direct services in the governor's supplemental budget, and we're going to start out with Ann Berry.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ann Berry, Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I'll be talking about four separate proposals. Three of them you've had before you when we provided a budget update about a month ago. A couple of those have been revised, and then there is a new proposal that is included. The first two are in the area of transition to community mental health services. There were originally three proposals. We now have put this together into two proposals, although we have reduced the amount by $1 million. I'll explain that in a moment. If you're looking at the budget bill language, we're in Article 4, Sections 4 and 5. And if we're looking at the budget pages, we're on pages C-151 and C-152. If that aligns with your pages, maybe not.
The handout that we have says budget page 22. Is that incorrect?
I'm looking at a different sheet. You're right. Budget page 22. That's correct. I'm sorry. All right.
Thank you.
So we'll start with transitions to the community. After we presented this budget proposal, we got a lot of feedback, not only from you and your questions, but also from advocates in the community. And so we've strengthened this proposal so that it actually creates additional opportunities for us to use our home and community-based waivers to serve clients that are moving into the community. And that was one of the changes. And then the second change was to reduce one of the proposals by $1 million. So we will still be spending a total of $9.2 million. We're requesting $9.2 million so that we can move clients that are both in Anoka Regional Treatment Center and the Minnesota Security Hospital and Transition Program in St. Peter, move appropriately into the community with the right kind of supports under this proposal.
And members, I've been trying to follow along, and I'm wondering if it isn't page 90 that has...
It's not 22.
It's definitely not 22, as noted on your sheet. So I'm looking at page 90, Mental Health Transition Services. Did that look right?
I don't have it either. Well, it's buried in there someplace.
Okay, members, do you have the Minnesota Department of Human Services unofficial engrossed version small sheets like this?
I don't know.
We don't have those.
I don't have them. That we soon will.
Yeah.
So, Madam Chair, I don't have in front of me what you have in front of you, but if you're looking at the transitions to community services for clients from Anoka and St. Peter, that's the first item in the governor's budget.
And so, members, I believe that's on page 90 in your...
Page
41.
It's 41. Oh, yeah.
Find it.
41.
Okay, it is page 41. All right. Representative Wofler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, it's both of them.
Okay.
And what came up last night,
right. Thank you so much.
Was that by taking money from the counties for people who have extended stays, by increasing that from 50, the counties picking up 50 to 75% of the costs, it pays for expenditures, as I understood yesterday's explanation that Mr. Coleman wasn't prepared to really address. But one's a revenue into DHS and one's an expenditure. And the question I had asked yesterday, and I'd love to hear Ms. Berry's response, was, you know, we're penalizing the counties for not getting people out, even though we have, you know, frozen the amount of corporate foster, we have, you know, caps on all the most of the waiver programs. To get 57 people out, we have major expenditures within DHS, but there's no data on how many people, if that's the same number that you're going to be punishing counties for not being able to find placements for when there's no service development on their end, or is it 57 on both sides?
Madam Chair and Representative,
Ms. Berry.
This proposal, which does include a county share for those clients who remain in either St. Peter or Anoka well past the time that they could be moved into the community. So there's a number of things happening here. One of the things is we are going to allow exceptions to, and I don't know that we'll use corporate foster care as the model. We're not certain that that's the right model. But we will allow exceptions under the waiver, under both the CADI waiver and other waivers, to move people into the community and then wrap them around with additional dollars. Because the limits on those waivers right now are so low that the clients that would be served couldn't be served in the community. So I think there's a real legitimate issue that counties are raising here, that the waivers that are in place don't have enough resources to support the kind of needs that people have when they leave Anoka or St. Peter. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we're talking about 50 clients out of Anoka and about 25 out of St. Peter. So we're talking about a total of 75 clients a year that would be moved into the community under this proposal. And we see it in partnership with counties, that we would actually work to build those alternatives that exist across the entire state. That's the second piece of it. And I think to your third question, and I think I addressed this once before when we talked about the budget pages, for counties who move people into the community and provide the kind of support and resources they need to live in the community, there wouldn't be a county share. So for that county share only kicks into place under this new proposal when somebody is still at Anoka because they no longer need a hospital level of care, or because they remain at St. Peter because we can't find appropriate transitional housing for them or transitional opportunities for them into the community. So for counties, and there's real differences among the counties and their placements into the communities. For those counties who do a great job and continue to do a wonderful job, their share won't increase because they're moving people into the community at the right time and into the right places with the right resources.
Well, Madam Chair, I would just hope that you would continue to work with the advocates in the counties, because I'm not hearing from them that they think this is a realistic plan for any of the three parties that are involved in this. And I certainly don't want anyone to spend time in the highest cost treatment services or in a hospital setting who's ready to move out. But as far as I can see, there's no service development money on the county side, that the caps still remain on many of the solutions, and that it may not be a realistic proposal yet. And I'd love to see us get to a point where all three parties saying, yes, we've got a plan and we think it works.
Thank you. And Representative Abler also had a comment.
Well, thanks. And I, this is a really hard question. These the services at Anoka at least are $1,000 a day or something like that. And they've been trying really hard to restructure that to make it hospital-focused with intense treatment and move them along. Is there evidence, Commissioner Berry, that some counties are more reticent to move their people out than other counties? And this incentive will actually spur some action that they can control?
Commissioner Berry.
Madam Chair and Representative, we do know that counties utilize services in our programs at very different rates. And it's something that you could see in the legislative auditor's report, both for the sex offender treatment program, and it's true in our other programs. We're focusing in here on Anoka and the security hospital. And the answer is yes, counties utilize those services very differently. I'd like not to have to ascribe intent to that. It may be that there aren't enough services in certain communities. It may be that they've met all their waiver limitations. There may be a lot of reasons why that happens, but counties do use our programs very differently. It's information that we can share, and so that you can make a judgment yourself about how those get used across the state.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
And just to the point of county shares, in the 2011 budget solution bill, well, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? We increased the county share from 10 to 25% net for the people that are going to Moose Lake. To my chagrin, I realized that was the break-even point. It cost $30,000 to deal with some individual in a less restrictive setting in the county for the $30,000. And it cost $30,000 for the county share to send them away. And I realized it should have had a higher share. And I didn't realize at the time that I had just helped them. So they can pay $30,000 and have no hassle, or $30,000 with lots of hassle. And so I'm just interested as we move along that this might be actually a good tool to help some counties behave better and to do things they can control. But I haven't heard testimony, not for today, but just as we go on, about some counties who have been dragging their feet. Because we can't have that at $1,000 a day when none of it's reimbursed, and so that's the idea. And you know, people do things when they're provoked. I should have gone to 50% share. We would have saved a couple more $1 million. And then some people who testified at our hearings in our task force would have, they went, oh, for $60,000, well, we can keep them locally and save $30,000. Then it would be a benefit. So I'm just my interest is piqued by the idea. So maybe it's a good idea. Thanks.
Thank you. And excuse me, there are no other questions, so if you'd like to proceed.
There are two more proposals I'd like to discuss. One is the, which has not been changed, but I just want to remind you that there is a proposal in the governor's budget that would increase, that would represent the increase in growth in the Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program. It is on page 96 of your large budget document. And this represents the growth that we will experience in this program if there are no changes to this program. We've asked that the resources, that the department be allowed to use these resources to most appropriately serve clients who are committed to the commissioner, so that if alternatives are created, that these resources could be used for those alternatives as well. But this just simply represents what we know will be growth in these programs if we don't make any changes in that program. It is not a forecasted program, like other, like maybe corrections or other programs. So we need to show the program growth in our budget, and it has been included in the governor's budget as well.
Thank you, Representative Liebling.
Oh yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Berry. As you know, we're attempting to make some changes to our program. We, of course, don't know whether those changes would, how those changes might change the numbers of people committed if we were able to do what's been being proposed in my bill and in the Senate bill, which is to bifurcate the proceeding at the beginning so that the decision to commit would be made before there's a decision about what kinds of resources, and nobody knows whether that would up the numbers or decrease the numbers, but it does seem clear that if we're going to change our system in some way, that we will need additional resources to make those changes. And I wonder if you have thoughts about those resources, because obviously they're not being proposed in the budget. Would is the thought that we might move around existing resources within the program, or what can you tell us about that?
Commissioner Berry.
Madam Chair and Representative, it is our hope or desire that you that this appropriation could be used either to fund program growth or added as an alternative, be used to fund those alternatives that would be built in the community. This represents an increase for, I think the number is 55 clients over the course of each year at a cost, you know, at the cost, the institutional cost. So if we develop alternatives, you know, one of the other things that we have been discussing is what are the costs of those alternatives. This money could be used, what we're asking, and is included in the governor's budget, is the opportunity to use this money either for institutional placements or community alternatives if they are developed. So as long as we're not restricted on the way this money can be spent, this money could be used for the alternatives you talk about.
Representative Liebling, follow up.
Thank you, Ms. Berry and Madam Chair. The other thing I just want to ask you to comment on is that when we look at this budget, we're looking only at the operational piece. We're not talking about capital costs, of course. And I know that over the years, MSOP has had significant capital costs because of this really sharp growth and continuing. The fact that nobody, for all intents and purposes, nobody ever gets out right now. So this is continually adding to the population. We were just talking about this on the other side of things with the NOCA and so on, but at least there, I assume some people do get out, whereas in our MSOP program up to this point, nobody does. So could you just comment on the sort of the trajectory of capital costs as well? Because if we keep going this way, you know, you've got the operational money here, but I know that, or at least I think I know, that the facilities are very full, and there's going to obviously be some need if we keep going to do something on the capital investment side.
Commissioner Berry.
Madam Chair and Representative, two responses. One is there is a capital budget proposal that the department has advanced and may or may not be included in the governor's budget proposal, but does include increasing the number of beds on our St. Peter campus for the sex offender clients. So that provides us some relief on the institutional building side. We're thinking a little differently about the way we use capital funds for alternative placements in the community. One of the models that we've developed in state operated services is to lease buildings and lease facilities in the community and then fit them for the programs. You know, so we add levels of security, or we would put that in, for example, in a request for proposal. So that the department has been moving toward a model where we don't own as much property, but that we lease that property and make sure that we get what we need out of that property for who is it, you know, in the contract arrangements that we have with the providers. So we haven't asked for additional capital dollars for these community-based placements if they come to fruition, because we think we can use another model that's been very successful in our other programs.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative.
Sorry, just real quick, Madam Chair, just wanted to follow up and say that you almost said the magic words around here, which is public-private partnership.
Thank you. Representative Abler, you had a question?
Oh, thanks, and just maybe a comment. I, in what did I call my bill in 2000? That was the best thing I've ever heard it said. I have to remember what I called it. anyway, and I felt really coerced in 2011 to fund the growth. And I remember my counterpart was wondering, why are we doing this? And actually, I'm going to go with the why are we doing this in the budget, and I'm going to give my chair advice. If I was you, I wouldn't pay for a penny for this growth in the budget, and make them look at their soul and see how they're running things up there. We heard testimony that it's about treatment completion versus status, and there's no law about treatment completion, and it's become a custom. And they have a person in hospice who is not completed treatment, who can't get out, and tale after tale about people who have been almost ready to get out. And I think that if we don't give them the money, they're going to be forced to actually deal with the staff and the culture there, which will be more conducive to a proper departure plan. And if we give them the money, maybe they'll spend it on alternatives. But, you know, this is sometimes money talks more than the politics. So I think that would be a that would be a safe thing to do, just to kind of help the process along, especially given that we're under some federal scrutiny to review people, and I hope we can pass the labeling bill about more frequent reviews of these individuals. And I think upon further review, some people will be deemed, upon status, will be deemed to be okay to be sent to a safe but different alternative setting. And so I don't want to take away the opportunity just to create those, but I know right now there's three that are under contract that are not being used. So that's just my comment, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Abel. Representative Liebling would like to make a few, a parting comment perhaps, and then maybe if you've got, then we need to move along. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I know we don't want to get pulled too much off topic, but I just want to say that I don't think that would be a good solution. And Representative Abler, I know you and I agree a lot that something has to be done on this, but I think we can't pass the buck. This is a political issue. And when this committee, when one person, after all these years, was lined up for provisional discharge, this committee or one of our committees last year or the year before called the commissioner before the committee and pretty much raked her over the coals, because as you know, right now under the law, she's involved. There's a political element to who gets released. We need to remove that political element so these decisions can be made free of that, and simply not giving them the money and forcing them to take the political heat is not going to work when on the other side we're slapping them when they take the politically difficult step to do that. So, and I know that's not you, but we need to make sure we get away from the politics here and start dealing with this in the level of science and public safety, and I hope we can do that.
Representative Kwan, quickly, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just maybe staff can clarify, when we passed the notification bill last year, in regards to that one release, is that going to cover notification for all of the alternatives that we're looking at and discussing in this? We don't have to really get into that now, but I'd like reassurances on that.
Commissioner Berry, did you have an answer to that?
Madam Chair and members, the notification requirements would not change. I mean, they are what they are in statute today, and we would continue to follow those requirements by statute.
Thank you for that clarification. And did you have more on this? Are you ready to move on?
There's just one more page that I'd like to highlight for you, and that's page 133 of the large packet. It's a budget change from the previous budget presentation, and it has to do with the facility at Wilmer. We have continued to operate an intensive rehabilitative treatment service program at Wilmer. For a period of there was legislation that instructed the department to keep the program open, but there were some difficulties because we didn't have enough clients in the program. It was hard to attract staff to work in the program. We've solved a number of those problems. We are now at capacity in that program. We have a full complement of staff. There's clearly a need to serve people who have co-occurring conditions, in this case both mental health, chemical health, and often our public safety. There are public safety issues as well. We would like to use, the governor is recommending, and we would like to use this $1 million to keep that program operating. And over time, as there's a business model that allows us to draw down other dollars, whether it's insurance dollars or federal dollars, we will do so. We hope to eventually operate this program in such a way that it's self-sustaining. It isn't right now, but this would provide us with the transition that would keep this facility open.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Offa.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Berry, I just think this is an example of how we have a real uneven commitment in the state to developing services where they're needed. This facility was built without a good business plan. We've tried several different models. Your narrative still says it's not able to bill more than 54% of its costs. And the part of the solution is that they will take some of the people from Anoka, metro people, who once again will be asked to leave their home communities where they're accessible to family and go out to greater Minnesota. And, you know, I mean, we really do need to have a really serious planning effort that relates the state resources to where the need is, because I don't think it's fair to ask people from the metro area to have their loved ones go to an area that's not accessible by public transportation, where they're served by people who don't look like them. And at a state cost of $2.7 million, while we continue to raise property taxes in the metro area without state partnership, instead state penalties, Because the state isn't a partner in developing those services within the metro area. And, you know, shifting it onto property taxes in the metro area and asking us to step up with state resources in greater Minnesota is just not a fair balance. And I think we really do need to kind of right-size the whole system and make it an equal partnership across the state.
Commissioner, are there any parting thoughts? And then we're going to move on to the next section of the bill.
Nothing else in my section.
Thank you so much. Representative Huntley, I believe now we're going to move on to the chemical and mental health portions. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Article 4. And so you have Dave Hartford as your presenter. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives. As was stated, I'll be reviewing 10 proposals this morning quickly that are, 9 of them have been heard in this body before, and there's only one new item. There is the page that you have, there's been some adjustments to this page.
And would you be willing to read those off as you go, or would you like me to do it?
I'll just read them off as I go. Because the budget page numbers are incorrect, so I'll just read them off as I go.
And as you start, please enter your name into the microphone for the record, please.
Dave Hartford.
Thank you.
The first item I have is to establish a clinical care coordination benefit in medical assistance, budget page 75. In that item, this is a system improvement item whereby we propose to take dollars currently being utilized for targeted case management grant that was initially put in place for uninsured and for other state dollars to be used within the counties, and this repurposing will create a new benefit and really upgrade the service, and that clinicians who are treating a child will then direct the care team so they can take the care plan and be reimbursed for that consultation time that it takes to really direct the care of a child. We'll take the $4.2 million currently being utilized for the MA match, so this will become used as an MA benefit, and the $700,000 will be taken as savings. And that's biennium numbers.
We're happy to see that. Continue.
The next item, budget page 77, and this is to establish a family psychoed benefit also in medical assistance. Again, this is a repurposing of existing funds. So the concept is in lieu of an individual therapy session with a child, the clinician would spend time with the whole family, really educating them on how to extend that treatment plan into interventions within the family. So there would be no cost. This would just be the establishment of this MA benefit.
Okay, you can continue.
Item number 3 on budget page 81, and that is to adjust adult rehabilitative mental health services payment rate and provisions of services. These, what's referred to as ARMS services, are really a foundational mental health service that help individuals through a variety of different services better manage their mental illness. The original, when this was established, rates were established. This area has not had a raise since 2006. We've been watching our system deteriorate over the years. We now have lost about 10% of our ARMS providers over time. And many of the providers that are still doing the service have stopped doing many of the services available because they can't meet their costs around it. The other thing that occurred when this was originally set up is different services like transportation, clinical supervision, there are other services that were not developed and put into this at the time. So this proposal really upgrades the service for not only an increase to make these financially sustainable, for these organizations, but also to add some new service elements that are really need to be part of the package in order to do the work that needs to be done. We're looking at repurposing dollars from the integrated mental health grants to establish an MA benefit. This item would call for a change in state plan, from what I understand. And really it does, kind of back to the ACA, kind of leveraging this $6 million of state dollars when taken into account the expansion population would become $16 million to, total of services to be rethought through in the community, but it actually brings many more dollars to the community to deliver services.
Okay. Representative Blueley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Hartman. Right?
Hartford,
sorry. Mr. Hartford, I am really interested in this whole thing of care coordination and that and reducing costs, and I think that's something that we, for years, we've kind of been moving in that direction. We know that's the way to get better, better value, mm-hmm. and so on. And I have a little bill this year to try to get some payment for care for coordination for kind of case managers within Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center in Rochester, mm-hmm. because they want to do some primary care behavioral health there. And so we have a very tight budget target, and mm-hmm. I'm worried that we may not be able to fund that, even though I believe that just like some of what you're showing here in your budget pages, that it would be a savings, actually. So I'm wondering if there's anything already in your budget that kind of does that. I mean, you've got it here with the children's care coordination that we talked about on page 75, and it makes total sense to me that there would be a savings, even though we're spending money on something we didn't spend it on before. So is there a place we can do that for adult mental health services? I mean, you're talking about these. Well, let me just ask you. You think, is there any place we already pay for that we are working on that model?
Commissioner Hartford?
Madam Chair, Representative, there's a great deal of effort going on within the Department of Human Services around this exact topic, the concepts of health homes for targeted populations such as those served by Zumbro Valley, and I know Zumbro Valley has been very involved in looking at health home models. So there's many work groups taking place as we speak around this topic. There's not additional legislation in the governor's budget at this point, but like I say, there are pilots being planned and parameters being planned to just because we see it as a really key concept moving forward that we know we need to improve coordination in mental health services between providers and also all of the integration, you know, with substance abuse providers within primary care. There's just a great deal integration work that needs to be done, so we're trying to align those as we move forward with the opportunities of the ACA.
Representative Lubin, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I just, I'm still, as I'm listening to this, I'm kind of struggling with how we might be able to fund this effort that, you know, I believe so strongly would be a savings. And, I'm glad to know there are pilots, and I know, and in fact, I know the commissioner went down and visited the mm-hmm. program, and from what I hear, was quite impressed with it as well. So I'm hoping that as we go along here, maybe if the department is, I don't know if they're, if I heard you that it's not in the budget to do that specifically, mm-hmm. but if the department is already kind of finding ways to do that in some spots, I sure like to know if we can find a way to do it.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would also just add that there are a great many, we've been in conversations and planning with many different mental health providers, and there are many mental health providers in the state that are very interested and kind of trying to prepare and think about these problems also. So just to kind of put that in, there's many other partners at the table also.
And Commissioner, it sounds like Representative Liebling's kind of getting at the fact that while you're saying it's not funded in the budget, it does sound like you're looking to provide some flexibility, at least in some areas, and perhaps I think she's suggesting maybe moving into the adult realm as well. Mm-hmm. And I guess my question would be, is there a way for you to consider offering some pilots out there under your current budget with this flexibility that you're talking about, as you're seeing here.
And again, at this particular point, I think that we would be more than glad to consult with any representative that would like to consult around particular information, because we do have a great many planning groups going on and not ready at this point to propose legislation.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just saw the headline, so I don't know if it's a legitimate article or not, but when you said that we've lost 10% of our providers here because of the inadequate reimbursement, there was just the front page of the City Pages this week is about another one going under, and if this particular allocation would give them hope or sustain them, I would hope you'd reach out, because you know, it isn't good for us to put the money on the table and it's available in July if they're actually closing now before we get there. And if you can do any intervention, that would be helpful.
Thank you. Representative Huntley?
Just a comment on Representative Liebling's discussion on this and the Zumbro one. That we had rules that said that if you go to a psychiatrist at one of these institutions, you can't also go to a primary care doc down the hall on the same day, because we won't pay for the two different visits. And obviously, you get into all kinds of transportation problems. Then the person is mentally ill to start with, and he has to go home, then he has to come back the next day. It's really... Representative Lee is right on the money on coordinating the care and do it in a much more reasonable way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm right on the money, but I don't have the money.
Good point. Commissioner, would you like to continue?
Yes, I would move to budget page number 83, Mental Health Specialty Treatment Service. This service... again, many of these are system improvements and what I would say adjustments to the system. One of the things that we've identified, kind of back to there was earlier conversation around people stuck in hospital beds for too long, because we have a gap in the state of Minnesota between what we would refer to inpatient psychiatric care and the IRTS level of care, whereby some people are too acute, really, or they have too high a service needs to move from the hospital to that lower level of care. So what happens is they stay in the hospital because that's the only level we have to offer them. This proposal is really to create another level of care between those two. It's a relatively small population that needs this service, and what this gets at... is to identify, we have a grant, an RFP that's out now looking to really create fund the gap between what our current IRTS level of funding has and what would it take to have a medically managed level of care. That means a psychiatrist would stay actively involved, higher level of care, and the savings are directly associated with, as a measure, AMRTC, lowering the number of days at AMRTC is one of the outcomes. But it's not just there. It's other hospitals, too, across the state. When they have somebody that it takes long delays to get out of the hospital because the care is not hospital level and there's not another facility. So this would help the whole hospital throughput by having this new service. And we're pilot, really, this is to pilot this other level of care in the state. And that's where the request is $1 million or $2 million over the biennium.
Okay, you can continue.
Next item, budget page 122, mental health treatment permitted in foster care. This is the new item that we have. Again, to recognize this is a very targeted population. This service was actually identified in 2005 or 2006 It's targeted for children that are in foster care and in need of mental health care, and the way that's determined is children who would have several items, like an inpatient stay, residential stay, several items that would need additional services. And this is a package of services that would be really delivered to the foster care, to the child in the foster care setting. We're looking, it was forecasted in, like I say, 2005, but never implemented because of the forecast. What we anticipate would actually be a savings from the forecast of $231,000, and for the 14-15 biennium, cost would be $161,000. And again, these are very targeted. Average length of treatment for these children, probably about 6 months, as they're set in these foster care settings. And then I'll switch. This next group are actually, the language is for tracking only because the language is existing, but the budget page number 73, expansion of school link grants. Just for time, I think most of you are aware of this concept for children to be able to receive treatment, reduce the amount of barriers that are, that there exist for children to get into services. These are grants that would, we want to double the number of grants available out there, double the number of children served. This allows identification and access to the providers for treatment in their own natural environment, much less stigmatizing. Looking at it, this isn't really an investment, again, to target this population. We know if we intervene sooner, the outcomes are much better for children who need this service. $7.4 million for the biennium. Questions?
I don't see any questions, so if you want to just keep going.
Okay. Page number.
Our folks aren't very shy, so.
Budget page 79, to expand mental health crisis response services. And again, on these crisis services, and I just want to point out before I go down, is the importance of addressing this as part of suicide continues to be 10th leading cause of death within our, within children between the ages of, it's the third leading cause of death amongst our teenagers. And the numbers double if you're talking about Native American people, rates of suicide. And this is really, this crisis service, this is a mobile crisis service. We currently have this service in 59 of our counties for children, 49 for adults, one tribe. And we're looking at expanding this, and the amount that's being requested here is to start up funds for four new teams. Those four new teams will cover an additional 16 counties, an additional two tribes. So it's startup money. This is an MA benefit. So once they get up and running, this is really start. These are startup dollars.
Okay, you can.
Okay,
the next
move
one
to page 85, and it's substance abuse screening, brief intervention, referral to treatment, commonly referred to as SBIRT. This is, the dollars being requested here are to train primary care clinicians in this evidence-based model, kind of back to how do we do a better job of integration. Well, this is another aspect of that is in primary care, we know that if substance abuse, if people receive, one of the most powerful interventions is from their primary care clinician to talk through substance use. Very powerful intervention. This $600,000 is a one-time over the biennium to train the staff to do that intervention in primary care.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. Since we don't have as much money as the governor did, did you explore at all whether or not we could have a continuing ed credit associated with this and potentially get some contribution from the people being trained?
We're
Commissioner.
Madam Chair. Representative, we're exploring all of those options now, at least as we try to get busy clinicians time to donate, to spend their time getting trained, whatever incentives we can find, we're working on.
Thank you.
Okay, you can continue.
The next item on page 87, the elimination of alternative to Moose Lake grant. These grants, it's a very deceptive name. Oftentimes people don't understand what this means. This refers to back in 1995 when Moose Lake State Hospital closed. The original grant was to create an operating subsidy for the hospitals right in that immediate area. What it is not is individual patient care. So hospitals that receive this subsidy, it's for general operations of the hospital, if you will. It's not attached to individual patient care. Hospital received the DRG or the whatever payment would be normal for them. This originally was geared more uninsured and dual eligibles, Medicare, Medicaid eligible. And over the years, this was rolled out to a total of 9 hospitals across greater Minnesota. As different state hospital closed, our system has evolved in many ways since 1995, creation of our community behavioral health hospitals in the state. ERTS programs have been developed, many different aspects, ACT teams, all of these have come into play. And with the advent of the Accountable Care Act, we're going to have coverage for many more. The numbers of uninsureds will drop. I would also add the metro counties in the state today. There are 18 hospitals, 9 metro, 9 greater Minnesota, that have what's referred to as an MA contract to treat beyond for patients on medical assistance. So there's that contract will stay in place for all 18 hospitals. The operating subsidy that only the hospitals in greater Minnesota receives is what this will eliminate. The metro hospitals never did receive that subsidy.
Representative Huntley?
This is a $5 million cut to the in total to the following hospitals, if you want to know. Thief River Falls Medical Center, Avira and Marshall, New Ulm Medical Center, Owatonna Hospital, Winona Health Services, Cambridge Medical Center, Essentia Health in Duluth, Range Regional Health Services, and the St. Cloud Hospital. So, and the idea of this when it started was that when we took the patients that were in the Moose Lake facility, they would need care in these various regional hospitals when they went back to their communities. You're not going to get that anymore if this stays in the bill.
Okay, and I think you have one last item.
And one last item on budget page 89. This is a one-time reduction in the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. Over the last number of years, unspent dollars, this forecasted program, unspent dollars have rolled forward. So we're proposing to, it's $18 million one time taken as savings to the general fund.
Any questions, members? Representative Fritz?
Well, Madam Chair, I do want to comment on the other the Owatonna Hospital that's in my district, and I can't be silent on that. In my nursing home career, when we do have patients who do require hospitalization in the Owatonna unit, we never can get a bed. And, you know, we've had to house the, you know, patients in the nursing homes for as long as we possibly can. And now without this grant for the patients that we had room for, what will happen is, when Representative Loeffler talks about the counties, the greater Minnesota and the metro, we'll all be coming up here to your hospitals and trying to find a bed because we won't have any place for to send our people. We've tried and tried. I've been on the phone for days as a nurse down there trying to find a bed throughout the state and oftentimes don't get any help. So now I guess we're down to nothing if we don't have this grant in my district.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, as I stated, this is a subsidy grant. This does not close a bed, does not change the care for any individual patient. This does not buy any beds. It's an operating subsidy that just goes to the hospital. So, not that I disagree, certainly don't disagree around timely access, and but that's this tool does not buy that. And that's where lengths of stays have changed. And because it's an operating subsidy, there's very little data that attaches this these dollars to specific outcomes for patients. So again, as we, as you kind of got the theme of repurposing, as we look carefully at repurposing dollars and trying to have them work as efficiently as possible, that's really what, as we looked at how hard are the dollars working in different areas.
And Madam Chair, and
Representative Fritz,
I understand all of that, but by taking any amount from us, is not a good idea.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have someone in the wings wanting to talk, but I don't think we were taking testimony at this point. We were just laying out the governor's bill, and that will come at another time, I believe, if that's all right. So, Representative Huntley, do you have any closing comments? And if not, we have Representative Fritz bill up. Representative Abler.
Yeah, just a comment about the carry forward thing. I tried to kind of scarf some of the carry forward monies and go after forecasted dollars that we hadn't spent. If you can get this kind of money, Representative Huntley, it's kind of a nice thing, but MMB always argued with me about it. But if you can get this, you might also want to look at some of the long-term care spending in the nursing homes where we're continually being forecasted higher than what we're spending. And you have to make a decision based upon a forecast that's erroneously high. And so I know you have a long weekend ahead of you figuring out how to do your budget, but when you forecast high and you have to make reductions, you have to make reductions that aren't even necessary. And so I hope that you can, that this one, this carry forward one holds up and some other ones too. Because when you're making, when you're buying new things, that's different. You have to be kind of conservative about it. But if you're making reductions you really didn't want to do, if you can capture some of those appropriation exaggerations or whatever, excess appropriations that were forecasted, it really doesn't, you don't have to make the decisions that are so bad you don't want to do. And if you guess wrong, it goes to the school shift, which is a fine thing to fix, but not but with our money. So I'm trying to encourage you. So hopefully that's helpful to you as you have an aggressive weekend with MMB.
Thank you, members. This bill will come back next week with some amendments, I believe. And so thank you so much for your testimony. And Representative Huntley, you may want to come back to the chair. Stay here for another bill.
You're doing such a great job.
Oh, thank you. So we are going to move on to Representative Fritz's bill, House File 256. We'll give Representative Fritz just a moment to get to the front, and I believe she has four testifiers. This is a bill. And perhaps a community member, and we can keep those testimonies brief, I hope.
We got enough. This is it.
Representative Fritz, would you like to move House File 256 for us, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to do that. To be included, correct?
Laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much.
Representative Fritz, you can speak to your bill and then introduce your guest, please.
Well, thank you very much. This is a bill that I have had before this committee a few years back, and I do have testifiers, so I'll be brief so that they can give their the information that they bring to this bill. This is the Minnesota Family Investment Family Cap Bill. This was capped in 2003, I believe, and it has been an issue of concern for many of us at this table and all of us throughout the state because it does take money away from our children and the needs and the daily needs that our children in this state require. So with that, I'm going to turn it over and start with Jessica Webster.
Thank you very much.
Right.
Ms. Webster, if you'd like to stand. state your name and give your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with the Legal Services Advocacy Project, which is part of Legal Aid. And so what we're talking about today is the Minnesota Family Investment Program. It's also known as the state's Welfare to Work Program. As many of you know, the cash grant that a family gets under this program is based on family size, with the exception of what we're talking about today, the family cap. In 2003, we passed a law that said if any new baby is born onto this program, we would deny that child assistance. This law was passed, as it was passed in a number of states around the country, to essentially discourage low-income children from being born onto these programs. But what we now have is 10 years of data that show that low-income children did not stop being born or they were not slowed from being born. And so we have denied assistance to thousands of children on this program. And I'm going to be brief because I think you've heard, many of you have heard this in policy and have heard me talk about it before. But the last thing I'll say is that this has been repealed in Maryland, New Jersey, and Illinois. It's seen as a failed policy. And one of the reasons it's seen as a failed policy is that people are on this program for they have a 60-month time limit. Most people are off of this program in 2 years, which means we're only denying assistance to children from the time they're born to the time they're about 2 years old or for 2 years of their life. And so this is a critical development stage, and that's why we hope the state wouldn't turn its back on children at this point in their life. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And our next testifier, if you'd read your name into the mic, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I represent MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. And MCCL has long opposed the family cap and sought its repeal since it was first implemented back in 2004. Today, 8 years into the family cap, statistics obtained from the Minnesota Department of Human Services and the Department of Health provide a lot of, we think, very interesting information. More than 19,000 children in more than 16,000 cases have had their grants reduced due to the family cap for at least 1 month. Birth rates in families that are suffering from the family cap have not dropped. And from 2001 to 2010, the overall number of abortions in Minnesota has dropped by 22%, which is excellent news. But the percentage of taxpayer-funded abortions being performed in our state has risen from 21% in 2001, prior to the family cap, to 34% in 2010, which is the most recent year that we have information for. Various academic institutions, including a widely cited study from Rutgers, have concluded that not only do family caps not lower birth rates for poor families, but family caps do increase abortion rates, which is evidenced by our own numbers here in Minnesota. On behalf of our more than 70,000 member families, we encourage the committee and the legislature to repeal the family cap. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I believe Andrea Fitzsimmons is next. Oh, Alexandra, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And members of the committee, my name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. We advocate for policies that primarily accomplish two goals, one, that improve child well-being, and two, that seek to strengthen the economic security of families, and we do believe that repealing the family cap does both. Generally, as you heard from Ms. Webster, the MFIP grant amount is based on family size. That actually is true no matter what. It's based on family size. But no adjustment is made for the additional cost of a newborn if the family was receiving MFIP assistance at the time of a baby's conception. So this lack of funds further financially strains the approximately one out of every seven families receiving MFIP assistance with a newborn. The current MFIP grant leaves a family of three at 62% of the federal poverty level. If an additional child is born, their income is reduced to 51% of poverty as a result of the cap. This is deep poverty and is highly correlated with poor childhood and adulthood outcomes. We have two main reasons for opposing the family cap, and I will be brief. First, the family cap pushes families deeper into poverty at a time when families are under a great deal of stress, not just the stress associated with poverty and its associated experiences, but also the stresses associated with bringing home a new baby. earlier, about a couple weeks ago, my former colleague, Marcy Jeffries, and I talked with you about maternal depression and its impact on early childhood. 44% of caregivers in MFIP families had a diagnosed mental health disorder in the last 3 years. The most frequent diagnosis, depression. One longer-term solution for reducing the incidence of depression includes addressing the broader context in which depression occurs. The significant role that the emotional and financial strains of poverty impose should be considered when evaluating the family cap. And the second reason that we oppose the family cap is that the deep poverty that results from failing to recognize the newborn child is especially harmful to the child and his or her siblings when they are young. It is not solely poverty or the degree of poverty that matters for child outcomes, but when during childhood the poverty occurs. Poverty early in a child's life is especially harmful for outcomes related to achievement skills and cognitive development. I'm going to leave you just with two pieces of information, two pieces of data. Findings from a 2011 Brookings Institution study examining the effects of family income on school readiness suggest that an additional $1,000 of average annual family income throughout early childhood will result in higher reading and math scores for children in low-income families. So relating this to the family cap, we're looking at about $75 per month additionally for a family, which is about $900 throughout the course of a year. And as far as outcomes during adulthood, according to a 2011 research study, for families with early childhood income below $25,000, a $3,000 annual boost of family income is associated with a 17% increase in adult earnings. So thank you for the opportunity to discuss this bill with you, and I really encourage your support in repealing the family cap. Thank you.
Thank you. Linnea House.
Thank you. Chairwoman Norton, members of the committee, my name is Linnea House. I'm the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota. We are a 50,000-member strong nonprofit organization committed to protecting women's reproductive rights, including the right to bear and support healthy children here in Minnesota. I'm here to testify in support of House File 256, and I strongly urge your support of this bill. As the law currently stands, the family cap within the Minnesota Family Investment Program actively denies family support to low-income children born to low-income mothers. At all levels of our policy work, NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota supports programs that allow women to make the reproductive health choices that are best for them and their families. This current law is a means of controlling those reproductive health care decisions, and we believe that low-income women deserve to have the support to deliver and raise children the same as every other Minnesotan. Minnesota public policy should not allow politicians to interfere with a woman's ability to determine the family size based solely upon her income. In addition, it is particularly concerning that current statute also states that there are exceptions for coverage if the child was conceived as a result of sexual assault or incest, provided that the incident has been reported to a law enforcement agency. This exception collides with personal privacy by requiring parents to disclose to the state of Minnesota how a child was conceived and the reproductive choices. We strongly oppose any types of personal privacy exceptions placed into Minnesota law. Finally, a continued investment into family planning programs that allow all Minnesota women the ability and the autonomy to make decisions about when to start or to expand their families is critical. Nearly a 250,000 Minnesota women are in need of publicly funded family planning services, and I also urge your continued support of these investments as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And I think we had someone from the community that would like to give brief testimony, please. We have one more bill we were going to try to get in today, if we can do it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Deb Konichny. I'm a member of the Welfare Rights Committee. We are an all-volunteer committee made up of current and former welfare recipients. The Welfare Rights Committee fully supports and encourages you to support a repeal of the family cap. We have worked many times to repeal the family cap in former years, in addition to the numerous other cruel cuts to MFIP families that have taken place. Right now, 70,000 children in Minnesota, 70,000 are living in what is considered extreme poverty. Extreme poverty means hunger for 70,000 children. It means homelessness for these children. And it means not even having a fighting chance at a normal and quality education. These 70,000 children are in extreme poverty, not only because of the bill before you, the family cap, but actually primarily because the MFIP grants have not had one dime of increase in the past 27 years. And there is a bill that would lift Minnesota children out of extreme poverty overnight, HF 433, which would give the first grant increase in 27 years. And yet it has not even been allowed a hearing in the House, and we want to know why. This bill is a finance bill, deserves to be heard in this finance committee, along with the repeal of the family cap, and we want to know why this bill is being silenced. We know that the budget targets are terrible, but it really has no relevance on the family cap, repealing the family cap, or increasing the MFIP grants, because the money to do both of those things should and can be entirely funded by the federal TANF block grant, which is supposed to be used for MFIP families. However, 73% of these federal funds have been raided to pay for other things, and we want that money paid back and used to repeal this family cap and to give a significant MFIP increase. So I want to appeal to this committee, and maybe even principally to the Democrats in this committee. You now have the absolute ability this year to bring 70,000 children in Minnesota out of extreme poverty and homelessness. And we want you to not neglect this responsibility. We call for you to take care of both of these things, because the time is now and it's long overdue. And we appeal to you to do this for our children and our state. It is the right thing to do.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And now it's time for members to be able to ask any questions they might have on this bill. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm not sure who the question is for. I got the first testifier's first name was Jessica, but I don't have her last name, Ms. Webster. So first question for Ms. Webster, if she's available. When you mentioned that those... most people are off this program in 2 years. It's a 60-month program. What is the percentage? What is those most people? What does that mean?
Ms. Webster.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, I think that we have people from DHS here that might be able to answer your question more directly on just the statistics on how many people are on this program and the timing.
Would someone from the department have that information? They may not be prepared. Okay.
We'll have an answer.
And Madam Chair?
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. While they're looking, if I can ask another question. Just
certainly, Representative McDonald.
Regarding the Minnesota Family Investment Program, I've met with some of the folks, Kathy Wagoner, this year, and regarding the program and looked into it. It is a great program, of course, and I think it's important that we, as a society, make sure that the children are fed. It was not their fault that parents are either not working or not able to. So I commend the past legislature to address this. I think the cap on the surface was a good idea, personally, from 2003, but as you look into it and study the facts, perhaps it wasn't. But the intention certainly was, because we want to encourage the folks to get to help them work. It's welfare to work. So my question leading up to that is, I see in the program there are penalties for not working, and I think those are good safeguards to safeguard that, to ensure that the program is working. We'd be foolish not to. But I see, I want to know from the department if they have this data as to how much we enforce some of the penalties if the folks aren't working, and perhaps they are all seeking employment. So, for example, the program says that if they don't follow the work rules, they could have a reduction of 10% from their program, and from the first month, and the second month could be a decrease with their utilities and other housing costs. So,
and it's with a great pleasure that we welcome former Representative Larry Hosh, who now works for the department, here to answer some of those questions for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative McDonald. To your first question with the percentage of cases that have been off MFIP, for 72% of those who enrolled in the diversionary work program and 60% who enrolled in MFIP, they're off within 12 months. After 24 months, 79% of people who entered into the diversionary work program and 70% of MFIP families are off the program. To the questions about the sanctions, we have we can get you detailed information through our systems on how many families are in sanction, at what level in sanction that they're at, whether it's the 10% level or 30% level. We do have a relatively complicated sanction process, but we definitely have the data that we can provide you.
Thank you. Representative McDonald?
Yeah, and I'll just finish up with this statement. As you know, it seems like welfare is always the first thing that people want to go towards to reduce or to fix. Or, you know, Representative Huntley and I had a conversation last night. That seems to be the easy portion to go to. Oh, they're buying alcohol or cigarettes and passed law. They can't do that and so on and so forth. Maybe they're not eligible and they were eligible to get it. But as Representative Huntley said, it is a small portion, but yet an easy target. And I think it's important for the department to give to us legislators, and it's our job to educate ourselves on the program. I was not aware that there was a reduction if they don't seek certain employment. Now, I understand I have an application here from the regarding the MFIT. This is all they really have to do is go in and fill this out, but there are other safeguards and thresholds in place to ensure that there's not it's not abused. So I think it would be beneficial to us to do our homework as a legislator, to do mine personally for my district, but the department to make sure that we're aware of some of those sanctions so it's not the target that it has been in years past, no matter who's in charge here.
And Representative McDonald, I would even go one step further and say it's not only wonderful that we get this information and necessary that we get it and to educate ourselves, but it's also necessary as legislators to go back and educate our communities, because there's a lot of misunderstanding about there that out there in the community that makes this a target, and we can help change that. Yeah. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. And I feel like I need to weigh in on this, and I was glad that the advocate from Welfare Rights came down to speak, because I actually was going to comment on some of those topics. And thank you, Representative Fritz, for bringing the bill and actually for giving us sort of a forum here to talk about these issues a little bit more broadly today. I think it's very, very important. And just to Representative McDonald, of course, I've been around here a few more years than you, and I've seen over and over again how this is an issue that gets politicized. And many people who feel most qualified to talk about it do so without any facts. And you've heard that actually quite a bit this session already. And I hope that you, as a member of the minority, will push back against that and join us all in pushing back, because much of what gets said and what is sincerely believed by people around what we call welfare is pure and simple mythology. It is not based on the facts. And even what the question that you just asked, which is very legitimate to understand how families are, you know, what happens if a parent decides they just plain don't want to work? Well, if you look at the money that people are getting on this program, I think it's shocking how little people are getting. And the fact that was testified to, that this cash award has not been increased in so many years. I don't know of one other thing that we do here in the state that has not been increased in that amount of time. Not one. If somebody can tell me, I'd like to know. And this is how we're treating our children in this state. As you very rightfully said, they don't pick their families. So, you know, this is the test bar is absolutely right. I don't know what we're going to be able to do in terms of the cash grants this year, but I absolutely agree with her on the gravity of this issue. And I know that we don't like to think of just giving money to people who are poor. But, you know, people need to live. This is a short-term program. It's not generational poverty anymore. Well, it's maybe generational poverty. It's not a generational program like it used to be before President Clinton reformed it. It is a very limited program with incredibly tight resources for people. And I know that they did an action earlier in this year that I wasn't able to participate in to get people to understand what it means to live on this little money. But even if you don't care about the adults, you got to care about the kids. And I really hope that we can do something for these folks. And I do want to differ with you on one thing. I wasn't around, of course, when the family cap was put in place. I doubt that it was really I doubt the evidence supported it then. I think that must have been based on mythology, too. Just guessing. The mythology that you're still hearing in this body from your side of the aisle that says that people have babies on welfare to get more money. I don't think they ever did that. Well, maybe they did it years and years and years ago. I don't know.
Representative Liebling.
But I don't think that's happened here. And I really, you know, I'm so glad that we're having this discussion today. I think it's a really important one to continue to really try to base this on facts. And just to follow on what Representative Norton said as well, I still get emails from people who, when they, for example, when they don't like the idea that we're going to raise the taxes on the highest income people, they say, stop spending the money on welfare. They don't understand that that is not where our money goes. So I hope that all the members of this committee who are learning the facts can help to push back against the mythology and continue to do that, please, for our children in the state.
And Representative Liebling, I just wanted to remind you, we've just got 3 minutes left before we're done, and I appreciate what you're saying, and I really don't want, I prefer not to go back and forth at this point, because what I think I heard really was a coming together in a positive way, and I don't want to turn it into something negative. So, Representative McDonald, if you would mind letting us vote on this bill, we have 2 minutes to get out of committee.
Madam Chair, if you give me 5 seconds, because Representative Liebling, no one said that on this committee, and that's really unfair to say at this body today, on April 3rd, or even this year, that anyone said that. Your statement, I'm not even going to repeat it, is really unfair. No one ever said that here. I've never said it. No one in this body on our side said it. And to even say it, to indicate that we've even thought it or said it, is truly unfair, and I'll end with that.
Representative Fritz, I'd like you to make final comments, and then we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion, and members, then we're going to convene until 6 p.m. in the basement.
Well,
Representative
thank
Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill, which is a very small bill. It's a repealer of that, although I just want to respond. I am very grateful, Representative McDonald, that you are taking the time to become educated and informed on the issues before us, and you've shown that all along and on both sides of the aisle, and it takes time. It's a big investment for us to do that. I've lived it, so I come here knowing what's and have the experience in my past, and then continue to, over the years, 40-some years of coming up here, testifying on these very same issues and really getting nowhere, except today we have gotten somewhere. We brought a group of testifiers together who are so far divided, and we brought them together for the children. And so we can accomplish good things, and we can get things moving ahead. Not fast. Well, we never do anything fast up here. And I am very concerned that we have not heard the other bill, and that those folks are still under scrutiny. But that is not the bill we're here today for. I appreciate all of the dialogue and the discussion and the coming together on this bill. And thank you, testifiers, and thank you, members.
Absolutely. So, members, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion into the Health and Human Service Finance Omnibus Bill. We are going to have to go into recess until 6 p.m. in the basement of the SOB, where we will take up House File 1064 first, and then go into finish Representative Huntley's Department of Health bill. So, members, we are in recess.
Thank you. Thank you, members.
I will call the meeting back to order, and we're going to start out with Representative Norton's House File 1064.
I would, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1064 for inclusion, possible inclusion in the HHS Finance Omnibus Bill.
Okay. Representative Norton moves the bill, and Representative Norton.
Thank you. Some of you have heard this in Health and Human Service Policy. We had actually what I thought was, for me, one of the highlight hearings that I've had this session. It was great. There was a lot of discussion amongst folks at the table, and Fartoon, who I'll talk in just a moment, did an absolutely fabulous job explaining the passion she feels for this particular subject, and it is my hope that we will be able to find some money, and I know that just makes all of us cringe on this committee, in order to fund a really important project and an issue that we're going to discuss here soon. And so, members, what this bill does, it's an appropriation for $170,000 in the form of a grant to a nonprofit organization, a Somali-based organization, to deal with reproductive and women's health issues in order to really address the health disparities that we're finding in this community and others, certainly, across the state. We do know that health disparities are a real issue, that the department has some
health disparities grants, and I think we'll talk about that here in a few moments with an amendment that Representative Abler has, and we'll maybe have a little bit discussion on that kind of little sidewalk that we're going to do on that particular issue. But right now, I'd like to introduce Fartoon Welly, and she's going to talk a little bit about the need for this project, the work that she's done, and what she hopes to accomplish.
Welcome to the committee, and if you would state your name for the tape, please.
My name is Fartoon Welly, and I'm new to this process, so if I don't say Mr. Chair of Committee, please excuse me. But I respect you all. As I said, my name is Fartoon Welly, and I'm the founder and executive director of Isurum Project. My job is to find an exit strategy of health disparity that my community suffers, and to find so the next generation of our Somali community can have a better life and better prosperity than our first generation, which I'm one of them. This bill is for Somali women, as I said, and I want to tell you a little bit about Somali women, because when we only talk about minorities, but I want to focus you to your attention about who Somali women are. Somali women have been experiencing civil war since, I think, 1988. According to the World Health Organization, every 30 seconds, a Somali mother and her child dies, with the highest infant mortality and maternal death. And so when they moved over here, you have mothers who have lost babies through, who had tried to deliver babies under trees, refugee camps with no clean water or support of health professionals. 96% of them, you have a handout, was that given? You have a handout that shows that 86% of something like that, Somali women live under poverty rate. And this is very normal, looking at the immigrant that came to America. All kinds of immigrants, the first generation, are usually poor. But what makes ours a little bit difficult is the scar of civil war and all the trauma that went through. So what we're trying to do is, you know, we don't want people to feel sorry for us. We have that immigrant spirit, and we want to move on and try to clear our own path to prosperity and become a contributing society of our state. I want to talk about a little bit about health disparity. Last three legislative health disparity reports were identical. If you compare all of them, even though written nicely, they also talked about how bad health disparities in Minnesota. But one thing that I could not find is a solution. And it was just a rhetoric that said we have to do something, but there was no a path to do anything. As that it is, we want to have a solution. And we've reached out and tried to work with the Office of OMH. And what we've realized is that the office is not ready to address our own health needs, nor the demographic changes that's happening in our state. As a result, as a public health graduate student and the first immigrant generation who were just graduating from college, my job is to make sure that we do not become part of the casualties, because our women already have been through a lot and lost a lot of family members and kids to famine and hunger and civil war. So on behalf of my community, who are our organization, we have 5,000 members who 86 or 90% of can read and write. And our supporters, I urge you to give us a chance to support our journey of self-advocacy. We cannot wait the system to change for us, and we want to move on. And the strategy that we're trying to find, which is funding for MAP process, which does It's a strategic plan that communities who are suffering health disparities use to organize themselves, to find allies, and to deliver a culturally specific health education that that can be.
If folks would turn off their cell phones and iPads and other things that might help with the background noise. So proceed.
Okay. So what we're asking for the funding is, I cannot tell you sitting here, give me money to address Somali health inequality or minority health inequality. Because to be honest with you, there is no method to address health inequality. So if you give me money now, I don't know how I can address the health inequality or the health need of Somali community, because there is no process to use it. The state doesn't have it. Our department of, well, I don't work for them, but because I'm public health, I call it our Department of Health, doesn't even have it. So this bill or this funding, which is so small amount of what I've been hearing people ask, is to figure out, is to use it and develop a strategy. How do you even address this need? What does it mean? We are so unique. We're Muslim. 90%, as I said, we're poor. We're immigrant. And we're black. We have our own unique health issues, our own unique identity and values. And one-size-fits-all system that now our state uses to address health inequality cannot and will not fit us. So you can throw $7.5 million every year at health inequality, and you will not get any dime of outcome. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Any questions?
Representative Patlin, could I just, before you go on, I just want to highlight the areas that Fartoon is interested in working on, because she didn't really touch on those, but because I gave a general topic of women's reproductive health. What she's hoping to do through a culturally specific approach to her community is to deal with the detection of breast and cervical cancer earlier in Somali women, to reduce the risk factors and increase the protective factors related to Somali teen pregnancy. And if you spend any time talking with her at all about the cultural issues surrounding that, it's fascinating. Increase Somali awareness of HIV, AIDS, and STDs, STIs, to deal with gestational diabetes, obesity, and postpartum depression. And it's those six issues that she's really focusing on, specifically with the MAP approach that she wants to do with this grant money. So I just wanted to kind of clarify that. Those are the topics. And if you have any specific questions for her, as I said, she has a lot of passion for making improvements within the Somali community in these six areas. And I think I have come to agree that the approaches maybe that we've had in the past do not work sometimes at all, but don't work for some of the new cultures that come to this country that function very differently than we do. Over here, and particularly the first generation, and I think that's really what she wants to address, so that it doesn't repeat itself year after year, generation after generation.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you, Representative Norton. You answered some of my questions, because I wasn't sure particularly what was the issue with the reproductive disparities, so I appreciate that. A couple questions for Ms. Willie. In your testimony, you said you probably were told this, that it's so small of amount, $170,000. Well, that's true to our budget. I think we get ourselves in trouble when we say $170,000 is a small amount. I don't want to ever get in that vernacular, and I know it's not. I'm sure it was someone told you that, because that's a lot of money, and I'm sure it's a lot of money to you. It's a lot of money to me and probably everybody here, I presume. Question is, how with these funds and these grants, Representative Norton, how particularly would these be used? And while you say there's one size fits all, females' reproductive system, and for that matter body, is the same no matter what, if you're Irish or Somali or whatever the nationality you are. So I'm not really sure exactly how this will be used in identifying some of those. And I don't know how these grants would be used to not have one size fit all.
Representative Huntley, I'm going to let Fartoon answer this question, but I do want to say she spent all morning sitting through our hearing, and so what she was hearing was a lot bigger dollar amounts, and so I think what she was talking about is this amount relative to what she heard this morning is small. But I'll let her answer the issues that make dealing with the Somali community in the area of reproductive women's health. Why is that unique?
Thank you, Representative McDonald. So about the when we're talking about anatomy of female, yes, they're all the same. But the reason I'm saying one size fits all doesn't work, you have to understand where we came from. There are no preventative care. A woman gets pregnant and she may never see a physician because it's not available. So when we came here, we're expecting that the women who had never seen a physician before to go through prenatal care and breast exam and pap smear and all that, all of a sudden to adapt into our healthcare system and our society and how we do work. That is a huge disconnect. It's not going to work. There is a culture. There is lack of knowing. There is this is a huge change. And to say that a woman who's educated, who have grown here, even though I've been here 15 years, the knowledge, the education, health education that was developed for American who was born here, and the health education that an immigrant woman will receive have to be totally different. This is a social marketing that we use as a public health. We say, well, who is this audience? What are their education? Is there a language barrier? Is there a poverty related? That kind of a thing. So that's why I'm saying one size fits all. Does not do at all. Even Americans who were born here, if you compare African Americans and you compare the regular white Americans, the infant mortality rate of African American is 14%, and if you compare to the American Caucasian, it's 4 or 3. So even those who were born here, you have to separate when it comes to health education, because there is socioeconomic factors involved, there is a culture involved. There is a racism involved if we talk about reality. So that's why you either spend upfront money, as I would say, it's not that much, I would still say, but you know what I've been asking, but it's a lot of money. I appreciate that. Or the $170,000 could be a high-risk pregnant Somali mother who ends up in ICU, and you will pay that $170,000 less than a month, because that's the ICU cost. So that's what I think I explained as much as I can. So there is a culture, there is a language, and there is a huge different culture. We are one of the worst famine and poor poverty in the world, and we're moved into one of the richest countries in the world. We cannot just adjust immediately. That's not going to be reality.
Okay. Yeah, other questions? Don't see any Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment, please.
Representative Abler moves the A1 amendment, and would you describe your amendment?
Sure. We both worked with the testifier, Representative Norton and myself, on some matters. And if you haven't heard me comment to the Department of Health about it, it's my interest in autism and some Somali matters, then you haven't been in any hearings. But anyway, so it's nice they're here tonight. I think it's an issue. And then Ms. Swellia came forward with some concerns about her own grant. And the way that we do some of our health disparities grant work at the Department of Health, and it's a very small department, and the money is not, it's a lot of money. Lots of millions of dollars. But anyway, anyway, it is millions. But it's compared to the challenges at hand, it's a relatively small amount. And unfortunately, there's not enough money to have the department lead on some of these immigrant population matters, which I think are pretty severe and I think are really our job. But anyway, so that's the backsetting of this. And so it's the intent of the author of the bill and Ms. Welly and myself to help those be better focused and better designed by people who are indigenous to the population that we're attempting to serve. And that's the idea of the amendment. And there's also a matter about a grant that she has that she needs some carry forward ability on, which, and we've talked to the department about this, and just so you understand, Mr. Chair, it's my intention to discuss this, and this bill, this amendment is not ready just yet. But in time for the omnibus bill, there'll be a, in concert with the Department of Health, we'll be having a, an amendment drafted about some work they intend to do internally. But so I wanted to bring this forward for discussion, and perhaps the author or the witness would like to comment about this topic. Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. When I first, I was very excited to carry this bill, and even more excited once I got to know Fartoon. She's a very talented young woman and has great, great hopes for change in her community, and I really wish her the best and hope we can help her. But it became evident to me through the discussions, not only here, but also with the Department of Health, when I was saying, you know, we have limited funds this year. How can we make this happen given our limited funds? And so I said, is there any way we can work with this? And then we found through this discussion that I think Representative Abler had as well, we learned that Fartoon has had a grant with the department before, but because of some kind of unfortunate events, that unfortunately made the paper of some bad eggs out there that were grant recipients, the department has taken on a methodology of dealing with their grants that you produce up front and they give you the money later. Well, when you're a very small nonprofit, you can't afford to hire people and do the work up front and wait for the funding to pay for people, you know, much later. That just is not a feasible way to run a small nonprofit. And so while good work is being done, it's become problematic to implement grants, even the ones that are currently out there. So I've talked with the department. They recognize the issue, and yet they're still trying to respond to what has happened already in the community. And how can we be protectors of the taxpayer dollars in a way that still gets the work done? And so the department is interested in continuing the dialogue. Representative Abler, too, has had an interest in this, and I think we do want to help not just Fartoon with this issue because it's other nonprofits that are placed in the same position. If you're a large nonprofit, it really isn't an issue because you have more capital to deal with, although I'm sure it's still unpleasant. For a small nonprofit, it becomes, you know, almost unworkable. And so I really appreciate the discussions that Fartoon and Representative Abler were having. I've been having them, too, and I think the department is interested in engaging, and hopefully we'll have some sort of compromise where the department might be able to do some monthly checkbacks so that they can check your work, if you will, and then release some funds or give a little bit up front and the rest of it, hold the rest of it out, that there'll be some sort of change that can be made internally within the department to accommodate this type of grant and others in a more productive way so that we can actually get work done in communities that we need to. So that's all I would add to that, and I want to continue to work on this issue.
Well, Representative Abler, are you going to...
Oh, yeah, and does Ms. Welly want to say anything? Then I'll withdraw.
I just want to say that I think one of the things that happened is that, and I don't want to bash the department, As I said, I looked them as ally because I went to school for public health, and all I wanted to do is make sure that people are, you know, healthier and they're productive. But honestly, it's just been reactive, you know. When you see a bad apple, there are all signs there. Our organization is 3 years old. We've done our all homework, and you can easily ask, you know, are you on a guide star? What is your account system looks like? But what happens that the grants, MDH, what they do is they give face value. And I could be, you have to be in that circle, you know, of a group thinking it's a relationship. And as you're coming as a minority organization, which doesn't have a resource when it comes to the funding, but you have a human capacity, they don't look at you as you have a capability of it. It's like, how much is your bank account? And I would say, if you don't give me the resource and you outsource the dollars that's supposed to come to me, how do you expect me to have cash flow? So all of this hurrah that's happening, and they're putting a lot of obstacles in front of us. It's just being reactive, and that shows that they're not ready to do the real work. So we suffer for it. I cannot pay my staff and the consultants that I've hired because I don't have enough cash flow in my account. Why should I pay the price? I'm trying to help a community that their need have been identified 1,000 times. So it took me in front of Representative Abler and Representative Norton to tell them, and this is what's happening. We've emailed the commissioner, we've emailed, and we wrote letters to from our board members to the community members to us, and the door have been shut. So we're talking about health inequality, and we're talking about dollars for health inequality. But they're actually becoming like a trap where you've just been humiliated. And if I was not strong and I didn't have the support of the community, and my intent was I already know what we're up against. People could close their doors already. The people that were paying the paychecks of the consultants were the grandmas, the cab drivers, kept us going minus into our account. And we have $70,000 sitting somewhere. How is that fair? And you call it the MDH or the Department of Health, who is supposed to be doing this? So there is an incompetency that we have to pay for it. That's all I have to say.
Representative Abler.
Well, and just to summarize, and then I'll withdraw it. There was a situation, what you've heard is the frustration of a person trying to navigate their way through a very interesting bureaucracy that actually means well. There was a circumstance that helped provoke this, and there was a grantee that had perfect paperwork, and they were all lies. Every accounting thing was perfect, and it all checked out like down to the penny, and they hadn't done any of the work, and they were just abusing the system. And so because of that, probably we made them become more strict. And so, but that had an adverse effect on the small grantee in this case. Anyway, so... yeah. I have no service down here, so I know it's not me.
Ditto.
But anyway, so there's this piece of the amendment that I had, which is, so the department's working with that. In fact, they're going to take care of Ms. Welly's situation without any legislative work to be done. They have authority within their department to do various things. And they're going to look into that as a systematic thing as a result of what we brought forward, which I really commend the department for their responsiveness about that. The second piece is to do, how do you assign the $6 million and what do you do with it that they're going to be doing on disparities work? And can you show some benefit that will actually dent the disparities? So that's the point of it, and I think it's been very productive. I thank you. Thank the department for their help. I know there have been discussions going on behind the scenes, and Mr. Koppel, who's not here, and others. So with that, Mr. Chair, we'll keep working, and I'd like to withdraw my amendment.
Okay, other questions?
For the bill?
No. Mr. McDonald, Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the bill, does the department have, the Department of Health have any other programs? Don't we have any other programs that address the issue with the Somali population? You know, I recognize the Somali population are a great, robust population that contribute a lot to Minnesota. They're hardworking, they pay their taxes, they're good family folks, and they contribute quite a bit to our state and add, I think, the quality of life that we have here. No doubt about that. So I'm surprised that we don't already have programs that help the Somali community when it comes to the women's issues, and we'll just leave it at that. And is there not already a program that we have that helps those?
The department's here.
So if there's someone from the department, if they could come down and ask.
Yeah,
Mr. Green.
He knows everything.
Poor guy. He's here representing the budget.
Mikey likes it.
He's smiling. Yes. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Greenman. Or welcome back to the committee.
Chair. Representative McDonald, we do, the department does have our Office of Minority and Multicultural Health does have grant programs that are funded both through TANF and through the general fund. We award grants on a competitive basis. I think one of the differences between with this legislation and other legislation is it's targeted to a specific community. We don't specifically target the grants to any particular community. We also award the grants for any number of different types of disparities, whether it's infant mortality, health insurance coverage, trying to get the differences between the sort of try to reduce the differences between some of our more at-risk populations and our minority populations. That's mainly the goal of that program. One thing I would say in response is that we certainly recognize that while we have a very healthy state, we do have one of the probably the biggest challenges we have is is the disparity, and we recognize that and know that and appreciate the concerns that have been raised tonight.
We, you know, in this state, we thank you, Mr. Greenman. In many cases, I don't know about the Somali population, but the black population in Minnesota has health outcomes that are worse than the black populations in Mississippi and Alabama. So we do have a serious problem in Minnesota. And Ms. Welly.
I think the reason I picked Somali community is that as either legislators or how grants are designed, they say a minority health disparity. So I say, who are the minorities? African-Americans, Hispanics, Hmongs, Somalis, Ethiopians, Oromos, who are they? Again, the mistake that we make here is putting everybody on one pot and saying, here. You cannot do that. That's why purposefully our organization pulled the Somali community, because we're very young, we're very small community, and if we don't stop right now, we know where we're ending up. We're becoming a part of the statistics of health disparities. We don't want to do that. We're immigrants. So by pulling us out of the minority health disparity, what we're able to do is articulate what our needs are, identify how those needs are met, and then people can get out of poverty. I think every community or every minority that fits that definition has to advocate their own issues. And that's why this is so focused on our own community. And I'm going to encourage and try to get coalitions for each community that fits the minority to do the same. Because, frankly, putting everybody together, the problem becomes unsolvable. But if you pull them apart, then it's not that hard, because you can have people like me asking you not that much money, but asking small grants. So, but when we need to address this issue. So I don't believe that we have that. I don't believe that everybody has to be on the same boat, because we're so different. We need so different cultures and values and diseases as well. So Somali community is taking this initiative of removing the from being a minority. We are a minority, but we are focusing on our own needs, and I would encourage every community to do the same.
Okay. Thank you, and I do have one question. Where did you go to this public health school?
Walden University.
University of Minnesota?
Yeah, it is Minnesota. Yeah.
You went to one of the top three or four in the country.
Thanks for the student loan.
So, any further questions? I don't see any, so the bill is waived over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and there's a little bit more work to do for Representative Abler and Representative Norton and the Department of Health.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Wait a minute. Representative Loeffler has a comment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was just going to say, as Representative Abler and Representative Norton work together, there is an actual Office of Grants Management and Administration that has done some problem solving in other areas. I'll just say the Department of Health isn't the only one that finds it challenging to work with small nonprofits.
Okay, so thank you very much for testifying. And next we'll change places.
Can you does it really matter, but this seems like a picture. Let me just
So we, Representative Huntley, you're continuing on with House File 1233, but we're now at the walkthrough of the Department of Health section of the bill. And so
that would be correct.
Okay.
And I would ask Mr. Greenman, if when the time is right to talk about sequestering and what that's, because that has a huge impact on the Department of Health, not so much in Department of Human Services, but a big impact with them.
Mr. Greenman, would you like to give your testimony?
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Dave Greenman. I'm the Budget Director with the Department of Health, and we're here tonight to talk about the Governor's package of budget proposals that impact the Department of Health. We know that you've heard these proposals, or many of these proposals, in the past, so we'll try to move along quickly. We've got a number of them to go through. What I wanted to do initially, I guess, is to talk about what's in your packet so you're aware of what we're going to be talking about. The first document is a two-page sort of a PowerPoint, which gives a high-level overview of our budget and some of the principles behind our budget. The second document is a packet of budget of our budget proposals. It's basically our change items that we put together that we'll be discussing tonight. And then the third document is it's a crosswalk that sort of walks you through, links up the budget proposals that we have, where they are in the fact sheet in the fact sheet, and where they appear in the bill as well, so you can follow along on both in either area if you'd like.
And members, you have a PowerPoint type looking handout in your packet, so hopefully you'll find that. There might be one in my car.
Madam Chair, I've also have a lot of very smart people from the Department of Health here tonight, so if I get too far astray, they'll help me out.
Okay.
To start with, I'd like to first have the committee look at our a table on the first page of the PowerPoint. This gives a sort of a high-level overview of the department's budget package this year. The base budget for the department is about a little over $1 billion, and that's all funds, and that's for fiscal years 14 and 15. Of that amount, about $150 million is general fund, so about a little less than 15% of our budget is general fund. Our spending, as appears on this table, we're proposing to spend about $59 million this biennium. About $40 million of that is for the statewide health improvement program, or SHIP, and that would be funding that comes from the Healthcare Access Fund. $9.5 million in spending, new spending would come from regulatory and screening programs. These are the programs that the fee-based programs that we operate, the newborn screening program, some of the programs that when we oversee different types of providers and healthcare facilities and collect fees for those, that's where that comes from. We are also requesting $7.7 million in clean water fund activities. Those don't come before this committee, so we won't be talking about those tonight. And the last two proposals, or the last two items, includes $2 million for core public health activities, and the second is a $200,000 savings on rent. These are both general fund items, so our net general fund impact of our proposal is $1.8 million for the biennium. We also have $9.4 million in additional revenue coming in. These are basically our fee programs as well that would come into the state government special revenue fund. So the total net impact of our budget is $49.6 million for the fiscal year 14-15 biennium. The next page gives you sort of a high-level summary of the principles that we follow when we put our budget together. The first was to focus on investing and expanding and maintaining evidence-based programs that address some of the most pressing public health needs we have in the state. This is the SHIP program. The second is to maintain core public health activities. We've had a number of, as Representative Huntley mentioned, the sequester will have a significant impact on the department's activities, since over 60% of our budget is federally funded. We've also, even before the sequester, we've had significant cuts in federal funding to our programs, and so we are asking for some additional funding to maintain some of the core public health services that otherwise would be in jeopardy. And then the third thing we're focusing on is maintaining existing regulatory and screening programs, making sure that there's a balance between making sure we meet our statutory requirements to have a balance between the revenues that we bring in for those programs and the cost of delivering the services. So with that, I guess I can start. Maybe we can start walking through the budget proposals. What I'd like to do is start on Article 13 of the bill. I'd like to start by talking about the SHIP program, and that's on Section 13.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Well, I just to spare us, I mean, not this, that's the wrong word, but what we did, the DHS had a bunch of change pages from the updated forecast.
Right.
And we already had a really nice time listening to this the first time when we went through all this. And so it has to be better the second time. But, if you don't have to say something, if something didn't change from the governor's supplemental, then we didn't make DHS go through all that stuff. If it's a hazing opportunity for you, we're happy to hear you go through everything. But I do have a question about the first one. But so, Madam Chair, just if you want a suggestion about how to expedite this, we could focus on changes and questions people have.
Representative Huntley, how would you like to handle this? This is, you're in charge of your bill, and I would like to honor that.
Madam Chair and David Greenman, if you would mainly highlight on the changes from the first budget proposal of the governor to the supplemental budget.
Certainly.
Okay. Members, unless you have any objection, that's what we're going to do. And Representative Abler, do you need to ask a question right now or before he speaks?
I've already messed up his presentation well enough.
Well,
so I do have a question.
We all
about
agree
the,
about that.
At some point, I want to ask about the status of the home health care licensing reform. So that's my question when we get to it. So.
Okay. Mr. Greenman.
I think my presentation got about 95% shorter than it was going to be, which is fine. The one new item that's in our budget this year that, since we last discussed this, is a proposal that would make some minor changes to our vital health record statute. It mainly adopts some new standards that from the federal government. It's such a minor thing, I didn't even bring a copy of it with me. But that's the one piece that we're adding to the bill that we didn't already have in the bill. It basically comes into compliance with some recommended federal changes in terms of how we handle vital records in the state. The other two changes we have are actually changes to the proposal. Changes that result from just different counting or from the forecast changes in the budget. One has to do with the mortuary science program. We originally projected that we had one proposal that would allow funeral homes that to, instead of requiring them to have embalming and preparation rooms in all of their locations, that would allow them to have, as long as they have an embalming room and prep room and in a single location, and all that work is performed in that location, we would be permitting them to have offices or funeral homes that don't actually have to have those, as long as they have a centralized location where they do that. The change there is we overestimated the impact of that on what we'd be spending in terms of bringing in new fees and new expenditures. We thought originally it'd be around $50,000 a year. It's actually around $6,000 a year, so it's a very small impact.
Mr. Greenman, we have a question from Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Greenman. I had a question about this on the policy aspect and what that means. I live in a border community, and we have funeral homes that have different locations in different towns and sometimes different locations in different parts of different states that are close to there. And so I was just wondering how that would work for a facility in a border town. Would they not have to, if they have a home in, say, Laverne and Worthington and Rock Rapids, Iowa, could they have the actual processes done in Iowa and then bring the remains back to the home that they're going to have visitation and that sort of thing, or how do you envision that in the policy that's
I would think
here?
That,
thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, our requirements don't necessarily relate to what would happen in another state and what their requirements would be. I imagine if we have a licensed, if there's a funeral home that has several different locations, some of which are in Minnesota and some of which are in another state, as long as there's a licensed funeral home that has a proper preparation room and an embalming room, whether that's in another state or in Minnesota, we would allow the Minnesota funeral home, or the funeral home in Minnesota that doesn't have one, to use the one that's in the other state.
Thank you. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. You have removed the need to have a prep room everywhere, but did you leave something in there about a holding room? Is there something about requiring to have more than just the, quote, chapel space, but actually a place for a body to be held separately?
Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Representative Lane, I think I'll ask Darcy Miner to come up. She's our division director for the compliance monitoring section.
Welcome to the committee, and if you would state your name into the microphone for the record and then give your testimony, please, or respond.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Darcy Miner. I'm the director of compliance monitoring at the Department of Health. Question was holding room. I'm sorry. Madam Chair and Representative Lane, yes, there is already language in the law that requires a holding room, and we make one change in this bill that clarifies that a holding room may not be used for embalming or preparation, but strictly for holding a body. But that is required still at every site.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler had a question.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Didn't expect to be discussing this tonight. Maybe Ms. Miner didn't either. But one of the things I'd like you to go back and look at is the requirements on hospitals, and that a greater Minnesota hospital in a resort area. I know of a situation which someone passed away, and they did not have a morgue or a holding room. The family had to, in the middle of the night, try and call around. The local mortuary did not want to deal with it unless you're going to buy the full package. Even that was someone from the Twin Cities, and the funeral would be here. Even though the family was willing to say, you know, we can't get anyone up here till, you know, morning from the Twin Cities, they had no place. Even when the family said, you know, can you just put her in a closet, you know, we won't tell anybody that's what's being done. But I mean, to have a brand new hospital, basically not have any accommodation for that, you know, I think we need to set some standards out with the hospital industry as well, because that's got to be a not unusual circumstance.
Ms. Miner, did you have a response, or are you just going to make note of that?
And I'm sure I've made note of it. Thank you.
Wonderful. Do we have any questions, or would you like to go on with any other sections of the bill that you need to touch on?
Madam Chair, certainly talk briefly about sequestration, if that would...
Well, that'd be good.
I think, are you going to touch on the home health care licensing reform? Representative Abler said...
Let me ask my question. Let's have them do sequestration.
Representative Abler's trying to say sequestration, and I think so. We'll defer, Representative Fritz.
Well, I would like to talk about the fees and the fines also.
Right, I think there is some interest in that, but could we defer that till after the sequestration discussion? Okay, if you would like to continue with that, and then we'll go back to the home health care.
Sure. As many of you know, in March of this year, the federal government initiated what's known as a sequestration, which results in automatic reductions in federal funding for a number of programs throughout the federal government. What's required is, as long as sequestration remains in effect, there's, I believe, approximately $109 billion per year in cuts in federal funding. That will go on for the next 10 years until there's some sort of resolution in Congress to the current budget situation. The what that means for Minnesota is something we're still trying to figure out. At the Department of Health, as I mentioned earlier, about 60% of our budget comes from the federal government, and we rely have come to rely very heavily on federal funds for both from the CDC, from the health resources, or from a variety of other agencies. We use federal funds to pay for programs such as WIC, family home visiting. Some of our cancer screening programs are funded through federal funding. These are all really important programs, and we're currently in the process of figuring out both what the impact is going to be on us and how we're going to make some adjustments to address these things. One of the frustrations we have is we don't have a lot of information yet from the federal government about a lot of guidance from them in terms of how to, whether certain programs are subject to the sequester or not. We have been seeking that information, and it's coming through slowly. One piece of good news we have is the one of our biggest concerns was with the WIC funding, and we did find out that there was, a continuing resolution passed in Congress that will continue the WIC funding at its current level till the end of the federal fiscal year. Which is really good news. That's probably one of the biggest programs that we would have had a hit on. In terms of some of the other programs, we don't have a word yet on when. What we're trying to find out is when the cuts have to happen. What our options are in terms of what can we do, for example, to adjust our programs to absorb some of these cuts. And in some cases, the federal government would. In some cases, fortunately, they were providing us with some information. And for the most part, though, we still don't have a lot of information about what our options are and how much those cuts are going to be. We have been able to make some estimates based on what we think we know in terms of the programs. What we do know is that in federal fiscal year 13, which is the year we're currently in, the reduction is 5%. On our federal funds, and anything related, not anything that's subject to the sequester, and then starting in federal fiscal year 14, the reduction is 8.6% per year in federal funds. If we assume the programs that we know of that are subject to sequester and those that we're looking at, and this is a rough estimate, but around 19, when starting in federal fiscal year 14, we'd be looking at around $19.8 million per year in cuts in federal funding to the state, which is a very significant amount. Folks working in our programs are looking at a variety of ways to deal with this. We hope that to get some information soon from the feds in terms of what our options are. For example, with regard to the WIC program, what are our options in terms of caseload size, in terms of serving families, what the vouchers, the makeup of the vouchers, what our options are in terms of how we would absorb those cuts. We've got, as I said, with the WIC program, we have gotten a good amount of information. It's the other programs that primarily that we are having trouble identifying what exactly this means.
Mr. Greenman, could you, maybe I missed it, but could you tell me what other programs are you talking about? You said WIC and other programs. You've gotten information about WIC.
Oh,
what,
I'm sorry.
What we've are got, other we, programs?
We've gotten some information as well about environmental health programs. The EPA has provided us with some information about what type of reductions we'll be seeing in those programs as well. And I believe we've gotten some information on a few other programs, but the information comes in very slowly, and it unfortunately we don't. It's not coming in any kind of a consistent pattern, and so we're having to go out and try to find out from the feds what those cuts are and what they mean for us.
And so, for clarification, mm-hmm. The Department of Health has a huge array of things that it deals with. You've mentioned WIC, you've mentioned environmental health. What other areas are touched by sequestration? You said 60% of the budget comes from the feds. Mm-hmm. How broad of your department, how many areas, how broad are the cuts? I guess that's what I'm trying to ask.
Madam Chair, some thank you for the question. Some of the some areas of our department, such as our Office of Emergency Preparedness, are that's sort of on the extreme end because it's 99% federally funded. So that's there's really no other source of funding for that program. That's a significant part of our budget. Programs that we have, other programs like our Child and Family Health or the Community and Family Health Division at the department, that has the WIC program, it has the Family Home Visiting Program. Those are all subject to the sequester. We have our Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Program, that area addresses a lot of chronic diseases. It has a lot of programs that are focused on specific chronic diseases like diabetes, cancer, stroke, those types of things. Those are mainly largely funded through the CDC, and those are, as far as we know, are largely going to be subject to the sequester. We also have a lot of funding for our IDEPC, infectious disease, epidemiology prevention.
Pretty good.
Our epidemiology programs. We receive a lot of federal funding for those as well that we use to go out and identify disease, to track, monitor health threats, things like that. Those are that's also heavily funded by the feds.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Representative Holly.
Madam Chair and Mr. Greenman, the funding that you used when I can't remember if it was peanuts or something that we found, Minnesota was the first place that determined where the problem was in the last couple of years. Is that federal funding that does that kind of work?
Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, I would assume that funding is probably federally funded as well.
Any questions about the sequestration before we switch gears? Representative Abler.
And so, Mr. Greenman, there's no supplemental budget request for that then yet because you don't know that. And so you're going to muddle through between now and next year and there'll be a deficiency bill or something for next January. Is that what you expect?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, we don't currently have a budget proposal related to the sequestration, and I can't predict what the governor is going to choose to do next session if it continues.
All right, thanks.
Representative Abler raises a really important point because if these situations don't get handled at the federal level, we do have some really big decisions to make here at the state as to whether we fill in the gaps or whether these programs close down because they're not federally funded. And as you've just heard, many of those are extremely important programs to the state. And Representative Huntley alluded to the peanut issue, I believe, that Minnesota kind of led the charge on solving that particular problem. And we have an excellent department, and it's in jeopardy with the sequestration cuts. See, I had trouble too there, Representative Abler. So I think we need to be thinking about this, and perhaps we'll hear more, or better yet, pressure Congress to do the right thing and get this done for us. So are there any other questions on that?
Oh, not on that.
Okay, so we're done with sequestration. We do have we have two things to do yet. I believe there's an amendment that was made deadline but didn't make the packet or some such, and so it's being copied. And so that'll be brought in here shortly. And then in the meantime, I know there's been a lot of interest in the home health care licensing. I think just to kind of say up front, I think people are going to want to share what they've heard from people back home on this particular issue. But in talking with folks from the department, it is an identified issue. They are working behind the scenes to try to solve it. And
So we can talk a little bit about what it is, and I think there's hope that in the next few days, perhaps a week or so, we can actually come to some resolution and bring that forward for the body. Representative Fritz and Representative Abler both have questions. Would you like Mr. Greenman to talk about this particular part first, or do you just want to start with questions?
Madam Chair, I'd like to have the department person who's doing the work come and talk to us. Mm-hmm. Could they do that and spare Mr. Greenman that? Since they've come all this way, and actually they may be one of the 5% who won't be here next year. I don't know who's going to, where the 5% is going to happen on the crowd there.
But Mr. Greenman, yeah, thank you. You could scoot over and please come to the table. Welcome. And we ask that you read your name into the microphone, and then perhaps you can talk a little bit about the home health care licensing provisions in here, and then we can address the members' questions.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Susan Winkleman. I'm the Assistant Division Director in the Division of Compliance Monitoring. And among other things, we regulate and license home health care providers. There is, I think it's Article 12, is the article that has a sizable proposal that restructures our licensing system and does all sorts of other things. Let me give you some overview on where it comes from and what the directives have been that led us to this session. There are two legislative directives that led to the project to restructure the licensing and enhance some consumer protective elements and also streamline it. And in 2007, the legislature directed the department to set up a stakeholder group, and we did that, and it's with providers and consumers and other agencies, and it was more of an open-ended charge at that time to figure out what, if anything, should we be doing differently with our home care licensing project. And we quickly came upon the fact that we have a very unwieldy licensing system in Minnesota right now, and that this proposal helps to address some of that too. And then in 2012, the legislature directed the department to come to this session with a comprehensive proposal to increase oversight and inspection of home care providers, and that's also what this proposal does. There are a number of issues. I'm just going to give you an overview and kind of a background before we get into the fees and fines, but I know there's interest there. There's a number of issues that we've identified in the home care industry as it stands now and how it's licensed and just in general in the field. There are increasing numbers of home care providers in the field, and at the same time, our inspection staff have stayed exactly the same. We have four inspectors to inspect about 1,550 providers. We are able, or in 2011, we were able to inspect just 108 providers, even though we conducted 182 inspections. So we had to go back 70-so times to make sure that they were in compliance. This is a dismal number in relation to the number of providers, and that's what we're facing. The fees have not been increased for some time. I think that we have a couple of different fees, and I think they were last increased in the 1990s. Home care, of course, has taken on increasing importance in the healthcare delivery system. It probably, it's before my time, at least in this area, 25 years ago, who would have thought all of the sophisticated healthcare systems and healthcare types that are being provided in people's homes? I mean, they were provided in nursing homes, and now they can be provided in people's homes, which is great until it isn't. In the last 3 years, we've also changed the way that we've been conducting our inspections. And even though we have such a small staff, we've kind of reorganized and rededicated our efforts. We've come up with a different way of identifying health and safety problems out there, and unfortunately, we are identifying health and safety problems. And so the types of problems that we're encountering are serious enough to get our attention and also to make us realize we have got to do a lot more, so at least we know who's out there. At least we know at least who's out there and have some sort of baseline. Because we have so few staff, we tend to respond to emergencies. It's happened a couple of times. It's not that we have enforcement actions every day, but we're not able to be out to many places very often. When we do encounter these very, very serious situations, we have to put all four of our inspectors on that one provider. And then at that same time, during those next weeks when we're trying to figure out exactly how significant their problems are and what do we need to do with the counties to ensure that the clients are protected, we're not doing anything else. So, and then another kind of general problem which I touched on earlier is that we have this very unwieldy licensing system. It's Class A, Class B, Class C, and Class F. That's not very meaningful to most of us. All the providers have learned it, but it does not speak to what is it. So this proposal also fixes that. We went from four licensing licenses to two. So let me kind of review what the proposal does in general, and then we can get to specific questions. The proposal increases the fees to support the staffing levels necessary in order for us to get out to every provider at least once every 3 years. The proposal would allow us to increase our ability to do complaint investigations. And also we have made some changes to the entry and application process so that there's some more documentation that they need to come up with when they apply, and so we need additional staff to do those types of reviews as well. We've also added a little bit of staffing for a better website and some IT work, desperately needed. We have information on our website, but I don't think it's very intuitive, so we're definitely interested in making that a better place for providers and consumers to go to. So the proposal also streamlines this four license types into two types of license. So a provider no longer has to get two licenses in order to do the same sorts of services but in different settings, and that happens for some providers now. So the new proposal puts it into basic or comprehensive licensing. So at the basic level, which is the ground level, there are no health services within it, and it's services to help people in their activities of daily living. And because we're not making it any health care, then you don't need to hire a nurse in order to delegate any of the care in that level. And then at the comprehensive level, they can also do the basic level. They don't need to get another license to do it, but they probably would want to use their non-professionals to do that sort of work. But the comprehensive, we estimate that that's going to be about 90% of our providers based on what they're currently doing. And that's the healthcare. That is healthcare provided directly by licensed nurses, licensed occupational therapists, licensed speech language pathologists, and all of the healthcare providers who are licensed. It can also be delegated from the licensee to an unlicensed personnel at that level. The proposal increases some of the license entry requirements. It can be as simple as a change just to make the managerial official sign the application and attest, yes, I have read the regulations. We very often get into these problems where the licensed professionals at some point in our investigation are saying to us, look, my boss is telling me to do it this way. So, I mean, that becomes a problem if the boss is then not maybe dismissing that person and then hiring someone new and continuing these bad practices. And then we have, we've also established a temporary one-year license so that everyone who comes into the field, we're making a commitment that we're going to get out there in that first year, and that they would not get a regular license until after they have demonstrated that they are in substantial compliance with an on-site visit. And then we've also made some changes to the licensing requirements related to medication management and some training topics. We've changed some of the training topics. We, as long as you're doing that kind of project, we reorganized the entire statutory chapters to make it a little better flow. We put the rules into statute so everything's in one place. We had, over the years, a number of different rules projects, and they're kind of Band-Aids all over the place. And then we also created an advisory council. And this is something that our division uses in other of our regulatory areas. And so it has, it's an eight-member advisory council, and it has membership from licensees, and it has three public members who can be either current clients or past or recent clients or also family members of clients. And then
We have a board of nursing member on there, too. We get into all sorts of nursing practice issues on a regular basis. And then we also have an ombudsman for long-term care member. So that advisory council would meet quarterly and be appointed as per the Chapter 15 requirements. And they would be responsible for providing recommendations to the commissioner and staff about emerging issues and trends, concerns and practice issues. These are things that we would bring to the council and get their recommendations back. Finally, the last section in our proposal is it's titled Integrated Licensing. And this is the most recent addition to our proposal. It's something that we worked out with DHS licensing in the fall. And as you might know, the DHS licensing is also bringing forward licensing for what's called home and community-based services. And I know it sounds identical to home care, but it is actually not identical. What we did is we were concerned about the possible impacts and crossovers between those two, between our proposal and DHS's proposal, and we got together. Staff got together in the fall to figure out, all right, let's look at these proposals. What's in them? Do they conflict? And what we discovered was that the services that are covered by each respective licensing proposal are actually different. But we do have some providers who are currently licensed as Minnesota Department of Health home care providers who would have to get a second license if we did nothing under the home and community-based services licensing system. So what we have put into the proposal under integrated licensing describes a process and a commitment to, by next session, for us to come back with the recommendations for combining the licensing systems for those affected providers. It's not to say that we have duplicated services between the license types, but we're saying that it's not good enough for the state to pile on. We're saying we're going to do it a little bit differently and choose one of the agencies for one fee and one license that comes from both agencies, and then work together on the inside on implementing both requirements. Now, how exactly that's going to work, we haven't figured out, other than we are committed to the goal. So we'll be working this summer on figuring out exactly how to mesh the requirements where we need to make it less onerous for the providers. That's the big picture overview of it.
Thank you, and I think we will maybe have some questions here. I just had a question on the fiscal note here. It appears there's a cost up front and then a savings a couple years out, if I'm understanding that fiscal note. Could somebody explain where the savings are coming from, or am I reading the fiscal note? Or it's not really a fiscal note, but the fiscal impact statement at the top of the page.
Madam Chair, you're correct. That's the way the funding sort of plays out. Under law, with our fee programs, we have to, over a period of time, have to balance out the revenues and costs. And so, initially, there are the costs of implementing this proposal are going to be higher than the revenues that we bring in. Over time, though, we expect that there will be more of a balance. The revenues catch up in the next biennium, and I think over time they'll balance out.
Thank you for that explanation, members. I know some of you. Kind of mentioned at the beginning you might have some questions in this area, and so Representative Fritz, did you have any, did you just want to hear about it, or did you have a question?
Oh, I have some questions.
Several questions. Okay. Representative Fritz.
Well, this is a very significant change and a large change, and I don't know when this process was started. But first of all, what is the fee structure today for a Class F home? How much is that?
Ms. Winkleman?
Madam Chair, Representative Fritz. Well, as I said before, we have four license types, mm-hmm. and Class F is one of them. Mm-hmm. And Class Fs range from $125 to $625 right now. Mm-hmm. And then Class A's and B's have the same calculation method, and they range from $100 to $4,000. And then Class C's have a $20 fee and a $50 fee. So the proposed fee, I don't know if I want, do you want me to go
Madam Chair, to the testifier, what are the fees based on? A $50 fee is, you know, or two.
Madam Chair, Representative Fretz, I couldn't answer you on exactly how they were calculated in the past. Yes. I do know that when we budget for fee programs, it's based on cost of staff resources needed to do the work. And as I explained earlier, the industry has been growing and we have been staying very still for a very long time, so that is one explanation.
And Madam Chair,
Representative,
and Ms. Winkleman,
yes,
you know, there's a lot to this. This is a, there's an awful lot of components to this, and you know, to me, it would seem prudent to wade into this. We have had, and I've talked with providers who have told me that they are paying $780 in a fee today and for a Class F license, but they will have to pay $6,000 for that fee under the new fee, under the new change. And the clients that they have are the same. Mm-hmm. The care is the same. And these are, you know, throughout the state, in the metropolitan, wherever, you know, the ADLs that you're talking about that they can perform on their own probably need to be queued. And there's a cost to all of this. And I wonder if, and I have no idea because I've seen nothing in this area about what the work has been done and what studies have been done to determine a fee increase from $781 to $6,500 for a Class F license for providers. I think, to me, that's the question. That is furthermost in my mind. And secondly, to wade into this, I say, I think you're going to, I believe this is going into law and going to be already implemented soon this year.
Ms. Winkleman, could you delve a little bit into Representative Fritz's questions?
Madam Chair, Representative Fritz, you've asked a couple of questions. I hope I remember them. Let me know. The fee structure and what you're posing is such a real issue, and the department understands it so well. We are changing, we are catching up very quickly in this world that has been growing without the department, and so we're trying to catch up. And the fees reflect the increased staffing needed to be reasonably out there within the once every 3 years, which we thought was a reasonable goal. There are, because we have these four fee structures, we have this imbalance. Some of the fees are calculated based on numbers of clients, and some of them are calculated based on revenues. We worked with the providers a couple of times over the summer to try and figure out, help us figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what would be the most fair? And frankly, they're in disagreement, too, about what's most fair, because having a fee increase like this is a big hit. Everybody knows that. So we recognize that it's a big difference. The difference too, though, is that we chose revenue based on it being the most fair, because we had some providers who had lots and lots of clients, but they hardly ever really had a lot of work to do with them. So it really came back down to revenue reflecting the amount of work that they're doing, and then reflecting the amount of work it would take for us to inspect. And so when you have a Class F who has been paying this kind of at the top, a $700 fee for a really long time, and then it jumps up, but then it's all relative to the revenue. So there's an initial fee that everyone has to pay, and that's significantly more. The initial fee for the basic provider for a new provider is $2,100, and the initial fee for the comprehensive provider is $4,200. Then you go into your renewal schedule. Your renewal schedule ranges from a low of $166 to a high of $6,625. At the highest range, it's for revenue greater than $1.5 million. And so that's an explanation of what the range is. We kept in this low fee rate of $166 because that is no more than $25,000 a year. But we wanted those people to be able to stay in. Mm-hmm. and that we imagine would be at the basic level or somebody who's providing a lower level or less frequent care. So that's what it's based on. We are in many conversations with all three provider groups. We've met with them last week. Mm-hmm. We've had many exchanges in between. We're meeting with them tomorrow. So we're working through our remaining differences with them, and you know, we recognize at the department that this is a big change. We're also recognizing at the department that we have a big problem out there that we need to address.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Wickman, I get it. I do get that when you only have four investigators for that many people is outrageous. And so, yeah, and you will, you do need to improve and increase and get out there. I think your board is good. The eight people, the ombudsman, and the nurse, the board of nursing, and all, this is a very good board. And the resident, the folks, and the families of, and all of that. And that's and meeting quarterly and doing. There's a lot here to take on. I'm surprised it hasn't. I'm always surprised up here that these things haven't been settled a long time ago. I mean, sometimes I think I'm not even in the right world because there's so much need, mm-hmm. you know, and there is. So, however, having said that, I just really am shocked by the amount of increase mm-hmm. in this, because this will close providers down in my district. In there's just no way that they can afford that type of a fee, and then the fines. Also, if we could get into the fines, but that's my concern, and I'm very happy to hear that you're continuing to meet with people. And I would just say, you know, whoa, Nellie, let's settle down here and pull back a little bit and see if we can't work out some and kind of cut some of these fees back, or if not cut them back, take some more time, phase them in, take a longer time to phase them in. That I would just like to say that, and that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. Representative Abler also had some comments.
Well, thank you, and I won't repeat what Representative Fritz said. I'm ditto to that. But I also want to commend the department, which I can do. No way. You do good stuff sometimes, and we set you off, and I'm critical of you sometimes, and we've had good conversations. And it's meant to drive us to a better good, and I hope I haven't offended you unduly. But this is really what I was hoping you'd come up with. This is listening to the comprehensiveness, and how much thought has gone in talking to the two departments together, which has been a really positive thing. We just talked about it again today with the Department of Human Services and the collaboration. They mentioned you by name, and it's really healthy, and it's where we need to go. And we do presuppose that when people go into our various healthcare services under your watch or under DHS, that they're going to be safe and that they're going to be, you know, quality providers and all that. But I think and I'm glad you're negotiating still. And so I just wanted to offer you some encouragement as the person who got you into this, that we didn't think you should do it all in one day. And that there may be some need to add staff and ramp it up and still deal with the biggest, you know, the biggest problems, and because I just did some quick math, $6,000 on a $1.15 million company is 0.5%. And these are, so $6,000 sounds so little, but then so that's actually turning into some money. And so that still is a hit, and no one's had a COLA for a long time. And, you know, I wish that could still happen, you know, but that's the challenge of the current state we're in here. And so, I appreciate that you're negotiating, and maybe on the fines you start at zero and go up to a number. If you have I think the fines went from 50 or something, now they're 500 on up, and 500 is a pretty big nick, or if you keep the 50, at least you can give more of those and kind of give guidance along the way. And I have not done any runs of anything. I don't know any details about what you're doing. But I know that you what you're intending to do, and I'm glad the discussions are going on. But I think from my point of view, as kind of if I'm the author of this, and glad you picked up on it and did such good diligence, that if it phases in over a couple of years, you're way ahead of where you were. And to Representative Fritz's point, it's not your intention to drive anybody out. And I know that's the last thing you mean, but just understand that $500 on some of these providers is more margin than they even see. And so I wish you well in your negotiations, and
this is going to be in the omnibus, and I want to also encourage you that you want to try to get done, but yet the process will be going on. And so whatever's in the bill, if I have any influence on that, could be called a placeholder while negotiations continue, while runs get done, and the phase-ins happen. And I know if there's a general fund requirement, that Representative Huntley doesn't have a lot of general fund laying around, which will add more pressure to your negotiations. Did I understate that, Representative Huntley? But I wanted to commend you on what you testified to. It's really good, and the collaboration in departments is really healthy, and I hear nothing but good things, Madam Chair, about that. On the two licensing wings of the two departments, which to this point forward had been, you know, two companies that didn't know the other one had a lot to do with each other. And so it's really healthy, and so thank you for doing that.
Representative Schumacher.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I have just a couple of questions about the effective date. And I did want to commend you as well for the 6 years in this. I think it's great to get ahead of the issue and have the thoughtful discussion before headline-type things come out and you're having to react to those types of things instead of putting together good policy. And I was trying to think of something that I'd done for 6 years, and I haven't held a job for 6 years yet. I haven't had the opportunity to do that. Maybe this one, but we'll see about that one. But when I look at the license change, and I think about the 6 years that it took to put into this, and then I look at how these changes are going to come into effect in October, I believe it is, if I'm looking at the right page on this. I was wondering what the rationale for the short time frame, if the department is ready for that, or if there might be some room for a longer time frame, or why October was picked and not some other date. Thank you.
Madam Chair, our Representative Schumacher, the transition period, I've been in regulation for many, many years, and so transition period from old law to new law, you try to make it long enough so that people can reasonably get on board, but short enough so that you have a shorter window where you're actually implementing two sets of laws, because you have to get your new people into the new laws and then your current people into the new laws slowly. And so the way that we set it up, we recognize is ambitious to start it off with October 1. But the idea was that we would have some advance warning that it was coming and be able to do some planning in advance. And then starting October 1, have the new people begin in with the new set of regulations. And then the current people would, at their regular renewal time over the next year, and we get about 100 to 200 renewals every month, would then slowly come into the new regulations. And as I've said before, I have been in contact with, we're in meetings with the providers about that issue and many others, and we are coming up with perhaps some options for that. And, of course, realizing that if you delay implementation too long, then what are we accomplishing? So we want to try and find that middle ground.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there other questions? I think this was a nice discussion, and we've heard not only in this area, but certainly in the other budget when we've been talking about licensing, is changes in licensing are very difficult, and changes in payment structures are very difficult for the providers themselves. And the last thing we want to do is have those providers decide not to provide any longer, because we know moving ahead we need more providers, not less. And so I appreciate the difficult position you're in, and just encourage you to keep working with the providers and see if you can't come up with something that everybody can maybe not like but agree to move ahead with. So we do have, I thank you for that, and we do have an amendment that we need to put on the bill. So this is Representative Huntley. I believe this
Madam
is.
Madam Chair, I'd move the A130362 amendment. It's from the Department of Health, so it basically gets the bill in the shape that the governor would like it to be before we take it all apart next week.
Okay, so members, Representative Huntley is moving the A130362.
And if somebody would come down and talk about it.
Yes, is there anyone from the department? I understand it's primarily technical, but there may be some. Mr. Greenman?
This is the vital records proposal that I talked about earlier.
Yeah.
I'm probably not the best person to talk about it, though. I don't know if somebody else can come down.
Welcome to the committee, and if you'd state your name for the record, and then maybe you can explain this to us.
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matthew Colley. I'm the Legislative Policy Director for the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'm probably not the best person either, but I'm a little better than Dave. but only on this. So we have staff in both the House and the Senate right now, so I apologize for that. This particular amendment deals with vital statistics, also known as vital records. These are birth and death records that the department keeps for the people in the state. And the vast majority of this amendment is technical language that the Federal Department of Health and Human Services puts out updates periodically on the best way to maintain a vital record system. So this proposal conforms to those recommendations. The majority of them deal with security and the prevention of identity theft. There's also some minor provisions about changing the name of our particular from the state registrar to the Office of Vital Records, so we're not confused with other organizations in the state. And then there is one proposal in here, and I apologize, I don't remember what page it is on, but it has to deal with amendments that individuals send to the state regarding these records. So the example I'll use is page 6 of the amendment. And what this does is that in regards to death records, most of the time we get the information from funeral directors in the state, and the vast majority of them are excellent at their job and verifying all information before they send it to the department. There is a very select number of individuals who don't always get the accurate spelling of names, for example, before they send it to the state. Because the way the current system is set up, they have a set number of days in which they can go back, verify that information, and correct it free of charge. The problem we face with this is that sometimes members of the family will come and ask for the death record. We don't know that the information hasn't that we have is inaccurate, so we issue a record with the wrong information on it. These family members can't get survivor benefits, Social Security benefits, those sorts of situations. It can be very hard and traumatic on those individuals to have to go back and correct this information. So what we're doing is changing it so that if we haven't issued a record, any amendments are still free so that they can send the correct information free of charge. However, if we have issued a record already, they have to pay an amendment fee that they, under current law, have to pay after a certain number of days. We feel this is a more accurate way to go about ensuring that these records have the accurate information on them.
Thank you very much for that explanation. And members, do we have any questions? Does Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of a process question, but this doesn't need to go through civil law. I'm not sure who, or is it going? Did I miss something here?
As I understand it, this will also be going to civil law.
Okay. Thank you.
And I don't know if it's going just in part or the entire bill's going there, so perhaps someone can answer that question, how they're sending it there.
Can you send it separately? They can review the money.
Okay. It's just, staff has just explained to me that after we pass the bill, the omnibus bill, then the parts that parts that need to go to civil law will be pulled out and sent to civil law, and then I understand sent back to be part of our omnibus bill. It will go to rules, and then it will go from rules, and if they make any changes, it will come back to us. Yes, we'll make the same changes. So this is an interesting process, but Representative Mack.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just to that point, so if I'm understanding, I guess I'm just a little confused because we're working off of what is the governor's bill, right? This isn't our omnibus bill. That's yet to come, correct?
Well, it will be. The framework will be the governor's bill. We're using the governor's bill as the framework. We will be amending it.
Okay. Okay. So it's fair to assume that the omnibus bill that we'll be marking up in however, whatever amount of time, next week or the week after, will not be real different than the governor's bill, but with amendments and changes based on the House's budget targets. Is that, I mean, as we look at the governor's bill, is that a safe assumption, or are we going to be looking at a whole different animal in 2 weeks, or?
Well, that remains to be seen, Representative Mack, but it is my understanding that we will work from the framework of the governor's bill. The committee will then amend, either remove and amend in, or just add to, supplement the governor's bill, and then that's what we will move to the floor.
Okay. And so this amendment in front of us, Madam Chair, excuse me, that we are looking at right now, and the issue that we're talking about with civil law issues and everything like that, is in the case that this is also in the omnibus bill.
Yes.
Is that what
That's
I'm
correct.
Understanding? Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Well, just a process question. I presume we'll be working off a delete all, I would bet, but that would be right. I mean, just to the question of Representative Mack, right? Representative Huntley would probably choose to bring a delete all, which will incorporate all or some or none of whatever is in front of us. And based upon his mood this weekend, probably.
Well, I think that's typically how it's done. But Representative Huntley, do you want to talk specifically?
Well, that's what I'll start with the governor's bill. Yeah. It'll have the same file number.
Yeah.
The things that I think we can afford will be in, we like will be in that bill.
Yeah.
And there will be other things. We've had some bills that aren't in the governor's bill, and we obviously have the financial problem, but there'll be one or two things added from the bills that we've heard, and then that will be presented to the committee.
Yeah.
And we'll have a day or two to make all kinds of amendments that people wish to make. And
I bet it passes.
But we're gonna try to vote for it, vote on it the end of next week.
Yeah, thank you.
So, members, we have before us the technical amendment. And anyone have any other questions about this? And then, if not, we'll move the A130362 amendment to be for approval and to be included in the omnibus bill. So, excuse me, we have a question here. I don't think your bill has been amended yet, has it? This will be the first amendment.
We adopted the delete.
Okay, so what we'll be doing is moving the A130362 into the omnibus bill as already amended. Yes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Great. Okay, Representative Huntley, your amendment is in your omnibus bill.
Not on TV.
And so now, I guess, members, I don't know if anyone has any other presentations or if we just have any final and closing questions. We have walked through all the technical parts that were new. And so, Representative Huntley, did you want to talk
Madam
to your bill?
Chair, I have a question for Mr. Greenman or somebody else. In tomorrow's newspaper, there's going to be an article about the lack of reporting of maltreatment of patients of various, but this relates, I believe, to human services. And apparently there is some law that we passed that said that the, and one of my question is does the health department also have this requirement to report to the legislature when they become aware of maltreatment of people? And the, for instance, the health department regulates nursing homes for the health end of things. Health human services regulates them from the cost end of things. But what when the nursing home was maltreated to the legislature.
Mr. Greenman, could you explain a little bit, if you know, or if someone knows, how the department handles if they find maltreatment during any of their inspections or in their dealings, and do they report it to the legislature, or what is your process?
Madam Chair, I do know one thing that I assume we're probably mandated reporters, so we would automatically have to report anything we found. I'm not sure about the reporting to the legislature, though.
Madam Chair, again, for the record, my name is Matthew Colley. After talking with staff, we do have an annual report under the Vulnerable Adults Act regarding all cases of maltreatment that are within our jurisdiction that we investigate on. Other than that, we'd need to a little bit more clarity on Representative Huntley's question and go back and see exactly what is being asked about. But our understanding is that's our requirement to report to the legislature.
So the question is, you do have a process for an annual report, but we don't know where it goes. Does it go to the legislature, to the department? Check on that?
It does go to the legislature.
It does go to the legislature. Okay. So if there's any other new and different information for Representative Huntley, let him know, and then he can share that with us. Wonderful. Are there any other issues that we need to discuss before we lay this bill over for possible inclusion? I'm going to continue with other parts of the bill. Okay, so we're going to take up this bill, different segments, different parts of this bill tomorrow. So we're going to just lay it on the table tonight and then lay it over. I know, not lay it on the table. I'm sorry. And then we're just going to meet. I don't have the time. Do members have in 10 a.m. in room?
This one.
Oh, in the basement, right here. So we'll see you all at 10 a.m. tomorrow. And with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.